Welcome to Medical Emergency in the Dental Office. You have a great speaker today. He wrote the original book back in 1978, so this book that on this subject has been around for almost 30 years. I have some bookkeeping things to do here. You have some course evaluation forms to fill out when you exit, and there's going to be a verification code plus your course code. You need both of those to get your CE units, and we'll get that number at the end of the lecture. And there's no standing in the back of the room, aisles or anywhere. And out of courtesy, do not save seats. Turn off your cell phones and pagers. And do not leave any personal belongings in this room, because we're not responsible. ADA will not take any responsibility. So now I'd like to introduce our speaker, teacher at USC, the expert in this field, Stan Melmitt.
The best kind of introduction. Quite sweet. Sure, sweet. Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Barry has left the building. He's back in Los Angeles now. Barry Bonds. He's gone. He left. As soon as the game was over, he's gone. Came back to where I live. I'm not a giant. I'm the Bronx. Bronx, New York. I'm not a giant fan. I'm a Yankee fan, Met fan. So, okay, medical emergencies in dental office. Now, the first thing people have been asking about is a handout, and all I could say is I sent the ADA the handout in July. And I emailed it, and I know that the internet can be slow sometimes. So here's what we're going to do. I don't have a handout for you, but I do have it on my website. So, yeah, I didn't make a slide for it, so let me just, here's what you want. If you want to do it, you can download this one, and the one for the afternoon, even though you're not going to be there. See, that's what happened. People were coming in earlier, and they're going to go to, you know, one of these how you make more money courses. Can I have Dr. Malamud's handout? You know, that's not fair. www.drmalamud.com/private. You're getting into my private website. So it's drmalamud.com/private/ADA-SF. ADA-SF. And there are two folders on there. One is the emergency medicine lecture, the one you're going to see right now, and the other one is for this afternoon on cardiac emergencies and using AEDs. They're both there. I'm going to leave them up for about a month, so you have all the time in the world. Again, it's drmalamud.com/private/ADA-SF. And I apologize for the – I don't apologize for them, but they screwed up. Okay, so medical emergencies and – oh, God. Yeah, isn't that great? That's my old life. Woo! Okay, let's get rid of that one. Okay. I just wanted to show you one of these new transitions they have. I love it. Medical emergencies can and do happen in the dental office. I have started this presentation like that for the last 30 years. When I speak about local anesthetics, which is the other thing I do a lot of, I start out by saying that local anesthetics are the safest and the most effective drugs in all of medicine for the control of pain. And then I show a video clip from a news program where a child died in a dental office from an overdose of local. So problems happen. And, you know, if you've been, or I don't know where you're from all over the world perhaps today, these things happen. These things happen. And it's the kind of a thing that we never expect to happen in dentistry. In August, when our freshman, I'm at the University of Southern California, ranked number one in the polls for football. Yes. Of course the Trojans. Yes. Fight on. And in August, the freshman class, oh my God, the class of 2011. This is getting depressing. Like, I was in the class of 1969, and this is the class of 2011. And they come in for their freshman orientation the last week of August, and the first day they get trained in CPR. It's like, welcome to dental school, your patient can die. You know, it's like, hello? Going to the dentist, it's not supposed to happen. Nobody ever thinks that way. It's always a shock when things like that occur. The problem is that things do happen. Medical emergencies happen in the practice of dentistry. So let's start out by going, again, you'll have all of these slides plus more on the handout that you're going to download, okay? What happened? Well, in the early 1990s, that's an amazingly long time ago, I'm in the process right now of redoing this survey, but I did a survey for one full year. I give presentations probably, you know, outside the university, traveling around, going places, getting paid, because universities, the football team gets all the money. And it shows, you know, and the faculty, well, you know, I tried to borrow this tie this morning. So I gave out a questionnaire to all the doctors who were in my audience for one full year. And the questionnaire dealt with their experiences with emergencies, medical emergencies in dental practice. And I got a total of 4,300 doctors, 4,307 doctors to respond to the survey from all 50 states in America. Oh, God, the Canadian dollar is equal to the American dollar. Life is not worth living anymore. It's incredible. I mean, going to Europe is for Americans is just ridiculous. Okay, these are all my personal problems. I'm airing, I'm venting, you know. See, by venting, I don't build up anxiety. I'm hoping to live a little bit longer. You see, I don't want to keep it internalized and just drop dead, you know. But I had 4,300 doctors from all 50 states and six or seven provinces in Canada, which we consider the 51st state anyway. And I asked them a very simple question. First question, have you had a medical emergency? Using, you know, whatever your definition is, doctor, have you ever had in your dental office a medical emergency? 94.9% of the doctors said yes. Now, they've been in practice anywhere from 1 year to 30, 40 years. But 95% essentially said, at least on one occasion in my dental practice, something has happened to somebody that I consider to be a medical emergency. Well, I gave them a list of 18 situations. And I said to them, let's go to the first one, syncope, fainting. Has anybody ever fainted in your office? Yes or no? And if the answer was yes, one time, two times, 10 times, 20 times. So these 4,300 doctors responded with a total of 30,000 medical emergencies. Folks, bottom line is, you treat patients. Patients come to see us. They want their mouths to be taken care of. You're going to come to the ADA. You're here at the ADA meeting in San Francisco. You're going to learn marvelous things to help your patients, new technologies. Bottom line is, your patients don't like us. They're afraid of us. They're afraid of going to the dentist. They tell you that. Dr. Malamud, please don't take this personally, but I hate dentists. And I look him straight in the eye and say, Mrs. Jones, don't take this personally either, but I hate patients. You see, I'm an anesthesiologist. I'm a dentist. I'm a DDS. But to the patient's benefit, I've never practiced dentistry. See, Malamud, which is not a Spanish name, but if Malamud in Spanish, play with it a little bit. Bad doctor. Got it? I'm an anesthesiologist, and in our dental school at USC, we have three operating rooms, and we put people to sleep. We do sedation, intravenous sedation. We do general anesthesia. These are people, anywhere from 3 and 4 year old children who have 20 teeth that have been destroyed by their parents, not understanding the fact that my child has soft teeth. I always understood that enamel is the softest structure in the entire body, right? Enamel, very like talc. It's extremely soft. You touch it, it just erodes away. Can I give my kid a bottle of Coca-Cola at night when they go to sleep every night? Yeah, fine. Bring them in. We'll do 20 pulpotomies and stainless steel crowns on a 3-year-old kid. So we do a lot of anesthesia because these patients, they can't handle dentistry. They're afraid of dentistry. A lot of the emergencies that we're going to be discussing are fear-induced. I use the same slide to lead into a lecture on sedation. Let's put it like this. Syncope, fainting, 15,000 cases, 50% of all the emergencies. Hello, happy people don't faint. If your patient sits in a chair and says, oh, you know, I love the drill, I love needles, I love whatever, they're not going to faint. It's that macho dude who is sitting in that dental chair, white-knuckling it, who's needle-phobic, but you know darn well because he's 23 years old, he's not going to tell anybody he's afraid. He may say to you, I just don't want to see the needle. So we're cool. We're all taught in dental school to hide the needle. Keep it down here. And you know that the more, if he said, I don't want to see it, he looks for it. He's staring at the whole thing the entire time. And what you say to me, if you talk to me about syncope, as the syringe came up, here's the quote, his eyes rolled up into his head. The pupils just disappeared. And he's unconscious. Okay, guess what? If you recognize fear, I don't want to go up in too much of a tangent because of the very limited time frame here. Think sedation. Think sedation for anginal patients. Anginal patients, angina, these are people who have, and I'll discuss angina in the afternoon, but the point is their coronary arteries, which supply blood to the heart, they're narrowed down. They've been eating all the good food here in San Francisco for a long time. And they get narrowed down, and there's not enough blood going into the heart muscle when the patient overexerts themselves, as in gets scared. If you sedate a patient with angina, they're no longer scared, and you prevent the anginal attack from occurring. Epileptics take medication to prevent them from having seizures. But an epileptic who gets scared has seizures. Sedation, take away the fear, is the way to prevent the epileptic patient from having a seizure. It's a very simple thing. We can discuss sedation for the rest of the day. That's how you prevent medical emergencies. And the other way of preventing medical emergencies is good pain control, good local anesthesia, getting that patient numb and not hurting them. Doc, I hate getting shots, but once I'm numb, I'm okay. You've heard that 1,000 times also. And the patient, you know, handles it. They sit in that dental chair and they white knuckle it. And then once that needle is out of their mouth, they relax. You visibly see them relax. They uncross their legs. They relax their hands. Take a breath for the first time. See, if you give injections slowly, you can have a patient die from asphyxiation. Because they hold their breath the entire time. That's why that could be the reason why most dentists inject too fast. Because they don't want to have patients to die from holding their breath. That could be the reason. But the point is, the patient now, his lip gets numb and his tongue gets numb. I'm hoping you're giving a mandibular injection if that's the case. And once he begins to get numb, he knows from his past experience that it's over. The worst is over. I can relax. It's not going to hurt. And then you start cutting on tooth number 31. And you're taking out this old amalgam. You're going to go in and do a crown, or you're going to do an endo or whatever it may be. And, you know, cutting on an amalgam, of course, is not a test of anesthesia. But once you get down to Denton, I think, unfortunately, doctors, you realize he wasn't numb. He had good soft tissue anesthesia, but didn't have pulp, because when you touch that dentin, this guy's on the ceiling. And that's when the emergency happens, that sudden, unexpected pain. So a lot of these emergencies on this list are preventable by recognizing the fact that a patient is fearful and doing something about it before the problem happens. These are the most common emergencies. These top 9 emergencies constitute 95% of the problems that you're going to see in dentistry. 95%. Now, this may sound like a silly thing to say, but these are good emergencies. No emergency is good. If you panic and don't handle these things right, there's always the potential for a person dying or suffering brain damage. I mean, it's hard to believe that syncope can lead to death, but it has. Just leave the patient in the upright position. The patient who fainted, leave him sitting upright. And it happened in Southern California 1999, more than a couple of years ago. 17-year-old patient goes to a dental office to have a tooth extracted. Fearful, given some sedation, you know. But the dentist sat the patient up, gave an infraabular nerve block, and the patient, to quote the doctor, eyes rolled up into her head. It was a female patient. And the doctor did everything right. The doctor yelled for the staff to get the ammonia, get the oxygen, but didn't position the patient. They didn't lie the patient down. You faint because your brain's not getting enough blood. And they kept the patient upright. Not meaningfully, just forgot. And then when the paramedics arrived on the scene, they found a 15-year-old healthy person in cardiac arrest. It is very, very hard to stop the heart of a healthy 15-year-old. But if you don't get oxygen to the heart, which is what was happening, no oxygen going to the heart, it's going to stop. But she was 15. Her heart is healthy. So they were able to resuscitate this patient. Yes, but her brain suffered severe permanent damage. Mentally, ever since 1999, she's been a 3-year-old. She's in diapers, institutionalized, she can't speak. I mean, she's alive. Hello, she's alive. You know, she was a successful resuscitation. That's not successful, is it? Okay, so these are the things that we'll be discussing essentially. These are the ones that happen. These are the more common ones. Number 10 on my list is cardiac arrest, and I'll be discussing cardiac arrest this afternoon. Now, cardiac arrest, 331 cases. Okay, it doesn't happen very often. But it does happen. Oh, by the way, 10% of the emergencies on this whole survey, 10% happened in dental personnel. We always worry about the patient. Yeah, you know, the patient, you could argue this. Who is under the most stress in that dental office? And the patient would say, me, of course, the patient. But you know what? This is, what's your first name?
Monica.
Monica, I'm going to pick on you a little bit, okay? Monica is a phobic dental patient. She doesn't like going to the dentist, and she lets me know it. And in fact, when Monica comes in, she makes me, you know, when I go to give her an injection, she's moving during the injection, and she's a patient who has to rinse out every 2 seconds, has to go to the bathroom every 10. You know, there's always a reason to stop you from working. Now, for Monica, seeing Dr. Malamed is the worst hour of her week, and she's going to be coming in for 3 or 4 weeks. The worst hour of her week. How many Monicas do we have in our office? How many patients like that do we see every week? And, you know, by her giving me a hard time, my staff knows I'm a fantastically fun guy on Monday morning. But don't come near me on Friday, because I've had it. When Monica sees on her schedule Monday morning, 9 o'clock, to see Dr. Malamed, her blood pressure goes up. When I look at my schedule Monday morning and see Monica's name, my blood pressure goes up. You know, and 10% of the problems were dental people. We work in that office, and we're human beings. Okay, and people in this room have problems. I mean, there are people in the room who may be epileptic, you're diabetic, and things happen. Doctors become hypoglycemic, not just their patient. Keep that in mind, okay? Cardiac arrest, we'll discuss anaphylaxis because it's a really important thing. It's important not so much in dentistry, even though I'm involved right now with 2 cases where people have died from anaphylactic reactions in dental offices. One is latex. Simple gloves, touch the patient, and the patient had a massive anaphylactic reaction. That's scary. By the way, I know of 3 dentists in this country who've died in the last 10 years from anaphylactic reactions to gloves. Dentists. 2 of them after they had their offices made latex free, whatever that means. But when they walked back in the office, both of these people, different cities, different states, different times, walked into their office after they were latex free. There had to have been some residual latex dust because both of these men, the first time they walked in the office after the office was cleaned up, collapsed with anaphylaxis. Scary. So we'll talk about that, okay? Bottom line is these things happen, okay? So now the question is when. And if most of these emergencies that we're discussing are stress-related, fear-induced, okay? Angina, syncope, an epileptic patient who's scared is going to have a seizure. Asthmatics who are scared are going to have asthmatic attacks. So when the fear, when the stress, when the anxiety becomes greatest, that's when the emergency is going to happen. So it turned out that 1.5%, 1.5% of the emergencies happened in the waiting room. Hello, yes, I'm a phobic dental patient. I'm afraid of needles. I'm sitting in your waiting room and I'm saying to myself, I'm safe. Nothing's going to happen to me here. I smell the dental smells and I hear the dental noises, but nothing's going to happen. And then somebody walks out and says to me, Stanley, hi, I'm Mary. Monica comes out and says, Monica, and she smiles at me. Hi, Stanley, I'm Monica. The doctor's ready. Come with me. Now, I'm not the brightest guy in this room. So I look at Monica and I say, Monica, where are we going? And she says to me, we're going to the chair. And she said it like that, you know, we're going to the chair. Yes, use that interpretation. Dental chair, electric chair. Think about it. For a phobic dental patient, it doesn't matter. Because that is where it is going to happen. You either get fried or you get hurt. Whichever one it may be. And if you're the person who walks that patient from the reception area back to the chair, especially with children, you see a change in their personalities, don't you? They become a little more guarded, a little bit more wary of what's going to happen. And when they sit down in that chair, then they hold on like that and they watch. They don't want to be snuck up on. Now, you've been taught, I don't care what dental school you went to, what hygiene school you went to, what assisting program you went to, you don't just walk into that room with your needle and say, open wide and give them a shot. I'm using the patient term, shot. No, you don't. You understand that they're a little bit apprehensive. You go over and you sit and you talk for a couple of minutes, schmoozing, talking. And that's why we hire dental assistants, because the patient's going to be in the chair from 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock and it's already 9:20. And you're still schmoozing. You're still talking. And your assistant sitting across from you, whether it's a he or a she, picks up their hand and points to their watch. Remember that meeting at the that meeting you went to at the ADA conference in San Francisco? Time is money. Got it? And now the great unifier in dentistry, except for orthodontics, the one thing that everybody in this room has to do in order to do dentistry well is get the patient numb. And guess what? 55% of all the emergencies happen during the injection. And if half the emergencies happen during the injection, and if more than half of the emergencies in my survey were fainting, you understand the most common emergency in dentistry is fainting during an injection. Well, you know, let's just discuss it and get it out of the way real fast. If a patient faints, it's because the brain is not getting enough blood. And if you're sitting up, blood is being pumped uphill against gravity. And when you're scared and sitting still, blood is what is called the fight or flight response. Blood is being pumped into your arms and legs. Fight, arms, legs, flight. To jump up and run out of the room. And if you did, you wouldn't faint. But he's macho. He sat there. And the blood goes into his legs and into his arms, and he doesn't move. Less blood returns to the heart. Less blood is being pumped uphill to the brain. And he begins to have he sees black and white. He begins to lose his vision, and then he just passes out. And the way you treated it was you simply lay him down. You placed him in a supine position. You lay the person down in a horizontal position. And in less than 10 seconds, he got better. He woke up. So I'm saying to you, and we're not discussing local right now, but we are, why not prevent the most common medical emergency in dentistry, which is fainting during an injection, by laying the patient down for the injection? I've been teaching local for 34 years, and I don't understand why anybody would want, unless you have a perverse thing about seeing mucous membranes turn white, skin turn pale, profuse sweating, and then when they wake up, vomiting. If you enjoy that, then keep on giving injections to patients in that position. Lay them down. Some people don't like that horizontal position. Fine. Just take the chair back as far as they'll let you go. If you maintain the blood flow to the brain, the person cannot lose consciousness. We can eliminate the most common medical emergency in dentistry by simply fainting during an injection, by simply laying the patient down before you give the injection. 55%, 22% occurred during dental treatment. 22% during dental treatment, 15% occurred in the office after. Most of those were patients who were in the chair for an hour or so, stood up and fell down. That's called postural hypotension. Let's prevent that one, because it almost always happened at the end of the procedure. Patients in the chair for half an hour, doesn't matter how long it is. Everybody has had it happen, by the way. You're lying down, you're sitting down, you stand up a little bit too fast, and you got dizzy. That's postural hypotension, but it can happen to some people to the point at which they actually lose consciousness. So the patient's in the chair, the doctor walks out of the room, leaving you, the assistant, to dismiss the patient. So off comes the bib. Now, what you then did is you turned around to start cleaning up, and the patient stood up, and next thing you did, you heard a thud as the patient hit the floor. Well, fine, let's prevent this from happening. Take off the bib, take a step back, let the patient stand up. This way, you're watching them. You're not going to be hovering over your patient and helping him out of the chair, but you're going to be there just watching them, because that's what it'll happen when they first stand up. Just be there close enough to grab that patient and prevent the injury from happening. That's all you really have to do. Virtually all the emergencies, over half of them, occurred, again, the injection. The most important thing we do for our patients, get them numb, is the thing that scares them the most. Bad combination there. Now, when the emergency happened during the dental treatment, the biggest problem there was inadequate pain control. See how all these things are tied in? Sedation is tied into this. Lack of, not recognizing fear, ignoring fear leads to medical emergencies. Inadequate pain control, sudden, unexpected pain, hurts. It hurts. And it happened most often during access for endodontics, pulpal extirpation, happened during oral surgery. Now, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm willing to bet, if we knew the numbers, I'm willing to bet 90% or more were on mandibular molars, because they used to be, well, they still are, the hardest teeth in the mouth to get numb. But now we have answers. So they're no longer a problem. Different lecture, different time, okay? But, in fact, I think Dr. Mel Hawkins is speaking here at this meeting. He's from Toronto. He speaks funny, but he's teaching local anesthesia. And if you want, he's a good speaker. You might want to listen to him, Dr. Mel Hawkins. But with the combination of two things, or two things in the last 20 years that have really revolutionized pain, not revolutionized it. We've had fantastic drugs forever. But the intraosseous technique, which you call the Stavident, one brand name, the other one was the X-Tip, that came around in the early 1990s, and that really, really helped, especially endodontists, get those mandibular molars numb. And then in the year 2000, along came Articaine. And we joined the rest of the world. We were the 133rd country in the world to get this drug, Articaine. Now, you know Articaine is Septocaine or Zorcaine, the American brand names. And we've eliminated the problem. We really no longer have a problem with mandibular molars. Better. But again, it happened most often because of inadequate pain control. That is the problem. So you need sedation if a patient's scared. Don't ignore fear. And good pain control. Great combination. I didn't show you a slide here of 5 dental catastrophes. I could show you 30. It bothers me. We had a young lady die, a 4-year-old patient die in Long Beach, California, 6 months ago, when a dentist put a cotton roll in the kid's mouth. And the kid and aspirated the cotton roll. And you know what happens with cotton rolls when they get on tissue? They stick. It goes into her, not in her trachea, but right by her trachea. It obstructs her trachea. And the kid is turning all sorts of wonderful colors. And the dentist grabbed a cotton plier and started jabbing it back there. And you know what a cotton plier does when you jab it back there? Everything starts bleeding. The kid died. Now, let's go off on a tangent. Very simple way of preventing that. And it's in my books. By the way, I have 3 books. Emergencies, Local Sedation. Come on, you need them. They're good books. And you know what I show pictures of? I show pictures of 2x2s, and we don't use 2x2s. Now we use 3x3s and 4x4s, because 2x2s are easy to swallow. 4x4s are harder. But you know what? All the pictures have dental floss tied around them. And if that cotton roll had a piece of dental floss tied around it, over, done, it's out. It's a little more work for your dental assistant. I don't know if anybody was doing that in response to what I did, but it's more work for the assistant, but it would have saved a life there. Okay, very important. 40 states in this country require a dentist to be trained in CPR. It's not certified in CPR. There's no certification. You pass the course. 40 states require a dentist to practice, to be licensed in that state, to have a currently valid CPR card. By the way, only 28 states require physicians. We're going to get to that in a moment. 40 dentists, 28 physicians. Before you call, oh, we have an emergency, call the RD, the real doctor. Call the real doctor from down the hall. We'll come to that in a moment. So here's something. This is unfortunate. This is a death. This is a news report. I want you to see what did this dentist do. He practices in a state that mandates CPR for licensure. Okay.
A 2-year-old girl dies after a visit to the dentist. Now her heartbroken family is trying to figure out what caused her death. They say no one is giving them any answers. KPRC Local 2 reporter Phil Archer spoke with the family. He joins us live at the Southwest Houston dentist's office where the little girl stopped breathing. Phil?
You know, it's hard to imagine a trip to the dentist turning deadly, but that is the nightmare that toddler's parents are living with now. And what makes it worse is not knowing why. Jessenia Valles died 6 days ago. Her parents still don't know what killed her.
2 years old, that break my heart, may empty my house. I don't know what I can do.
She apparently stopped breathing while she was having dental work done at the Good Shepherd Dental Clinic in Southwest Houston. Her mother was there, but says she wasn't allowed in the room with her daughter. At one point during the examination, she says she heard the girl crying through the door, but was assured she was all right. Jessenia's mother says she didn't know anything was wrong until a nurse carried her daughter out of the examination room unconscious, then rushed her out the front door of the dental clinic to a doctor's office next door. An ambulance carried her from there to Southwest Memorial Hospital, where she was pronounced dead. Her parents say they asked the dentist, Dr. Robert Choi, for an explanation.
And the doctor say, I don't know what happened. That's all he talk. I don't know what happened. That's easy. Say, I don't know what happened.
This afternoon, we tried to ask Dr. Choi the same question.
Dr. Choi?
I'm going to stop it right there because now it gets into this chasing him around the office with a microphone kind of thing. When the emergency happened, this is an office where the doctor and the hygienist at least are trained in CPR. They carried the unconscious kid out into the parking lot looking for a physician. It makes no sense. They panicked. Bottom line is they panicked. And other cases I've been involved with, a doctor calls 911. There's a cardiac arrest in his office. And when the paramedics arrived, the ambulance arrived in the office, they found the doctor and the entire staff waiting in the parking lot. And another case that occurred, these are all cardiac arrest cases. They may not have started out, but by the doctors not doing anything, it led to that. When the paramedics arrived in this dental office, the doctor and the entire staff were sitting in their chairs around the dental chair where the patient was, and they were all crying. And another case, the doctor and staff were standing over here in the corner of the room. They were all holding hands in prayer. In every one of these cases, the person in that chair was dead because they did nothing. They did nothing. And yet every one of these doctors, every one of them works in a state that mandates CPR for licensure. They panicked. And if you panic, whoever that person is who needs help, they're dead. If you panic, and that's it. You can't afford to panic. You know, can medical emergencies have a satisfying outcome? Of course they can. There were 30,000 medical emergencies in that survey. Maybe a couple. I don't mean to say it like that. It sounds like, just maybe a couple died. But overwhelming number. You ever think about fainting. Think about fainting. It happens. And you handle it. Yes, medical emergencies and dental practices do have a satisfying outcome most of the time. I'm going to go over this case a little later, but this young lady, Lori Jacobs, is a pediatric dentist in Wilmington, Delaware. This slide is probably now 15 years old. This is the headline on page 40. By the way, if the patient had died, it would have been on page 2 or 1. Dentist thinks fast, saves a life, and we'll discuss the case. But what it was the parent, not the kid, the parent, had an anaphylactic reaction while she was in the dental office, something she had taken at home. But all of a sudden, she couldn't breathe. She began wheezing. The doctor recognized it and knew what to do and did it. And the person survived. She thought fast, and she gave drugs. She wasn't afraid to give the drugs. And we'll discuss anaphylaxis because it's a very important medical emergency, more so in your private life than it is in your dental life. By the way, everything we're discussing here today is a medical emergency. They're not dental office medical emergencies. They're medical emergencies. July 26, 2006, on the Internet. And, you know, when you're writing the Internet, your old grammar, all sense of proper writing goes out the window here, but I'll read it to you. Well, never thought it would happen, but was ready. My assistant of 25 years, a history of 2 myocardial infarctions, heart attacks in lay terms. We had just finished eating about 10 minutes before. I looked over at her, hand on chest, tingling in fingers. That's one of her signs. Crushing pain to the chest. We got her a nitroglycerin and an aspirin. We called 911 and took her blood pressure. Luckily, they are a half a block away. We had the AED, oxygen, and the emergency kit ready, but didn't need it. And then he winds up with a great statement. Could somebody mail me a new pair of shorts? So we did. The one thing about this statement that is not accurate, you know, when he said they called 911, then it says, luckily, they are half a block away. That is inaccurate. Luckily, they were half a block away and were in. That's a very common mistake that you make. I'm right down the street from that fire station. Yes, but the fire station says San Francisco Fire Department, not Dr. Malamud's private ambulance. We sit and wait for him to call. My university, my dental school, literally from here to the back of that room, this is a street between me and that place over there, Jefferson Boulevard. There's a fire station right there. And you could literally walk over there probably in 15 seconds. When we call 911 at our dental school, and we have 700 students, things happen. Easily 10, 15 minutes before anybody shows up, easily. And you know why? That street is the boundary. That's not our fire station. Our fire station is 5 miles down this other street. Now, if I stagger across the street and collapse in front of the fire station, they'll treat me. But they will not. They're not the primary firehouse for our side of the street. Just keep that in mind, okay? Keep that in mind. Okay, so let's get into preparation here. Preparation, and let's talk about some legalities. And I hate to have to do that, but we're in California, folks. California's got 130,000 dentists and 100,000 attorneys. And if you pick up the, I'm from Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Times on Sunday, go to the sports section. There are going to be advertisements from attorneys in there. Have you ever been mistreated by a dentist or physician? Call me. Yeah? You see the ads on television when you watch late night TV. You have this person, attorney so-and-so got me a $2 million. You know, they're out there looking. They're looking to make money. And where are they? We got 30,000 of us in the state of California. Our legal responsibility as doctors in a medical emergency is really simple. Recognize the fact that something is wrong and then do something about it. Now, this, see, I have to interpret terms here. Activate emergency medical services, which is 911, immediately, stat means immediately, if needed. Nobody in this room can make that decision except you. If you are, you know, you're the doctor in the office, and if something happens to somebody in the office, and if you are nervous, if you have any doubts about what's going on, call 911. Don't be afraid. We'll discuss that in a little bit. But calling for help, there's nothing wrong with calling for help. Not calling for help and then realizing too late that you needed it, that's a tough one to defend. Now, let's get down to the actual really important statement, and that is this. This is what you need to do in a medical emergency. And it's really, that's why it's so simple. Your job in a medical emergency as a doctor is to keep this person alive. Keep the person alive until one of two things happen. One, they get better. Two, somebody comes along who is better trained than you are and takes over their management. So examples of gets better, fainting. Low blood sugar, give them a glass of orange juice. The asthmatic who picks up their own inhaler. The person who has chest pain, angina, who takes their nitroglycerin. That was at Bolero? I feel like having sex with Bo Derek. I'm just testing your age in that one. Now, most of them go, huh? Who's Bo who? If I said Bo Diddley, you wouldn't even know that either. I mean, this is... This is the job. This is our job. Keep the victim alive. See, they're going to do a heavy edit job on this tape they're doing. They're going to do a lot of editing here. Keep the victim alive until they either recover or somebody arrives on the scene to take over their management. As long as those people or that person is better trained than you. I think that makes sense, doesn't it? You're not going to, hey, you, guy in the street, come over here. You know, better trained than you. So let's talk about preparation. And I'm a David Letterman fan, and my wife is a Jay Leno fan, and every night at 11:30 we have a fight. I want to watch his top 10 list. She wants to watch his monologue. And you know, I'm married 42 years. She wins. I always wind up falling asleep in the damn living room. And I got to stagger upstairs and try to fall asleep after I wake. It's horrible. Top 10 list. Basic life support, basic life support, basic life support times 7. That's it. It's the most. It is absolute of the set of the 10 things you need. It's basic life support, which is also known as CPR. This is what you do. In every medical emergency, this is the most important thing that we do. The guidelines have changed. Now, again, I'm not going to discuss cardiac problems this morning. I'm going to spend the whole afternoon discussing cardiac problems. But it's basic life support. You do it. You do this when a patient faints. You do it in any medical emergency, and you'll see these slides coming up. The guidelines change, and the most recent guidelines were published in December of 2005, went into effect in March of 2006. I don't care if you're in one of those 10 states that don't get it. Remember, 40 states require CPR. 10 states that are losers, that just don't understand, they should secede from the union. They should just have another confederacy. Because I don't understand how they can allow a healthcare provider to practice, to administer drugs to a patient and not mandate that that doctor be trained to save the life of that person. Because anything, just treating a patient, patients faint. Okay, you put a drug into a patient, there are things that can go wrong. I don't care how safe the drug is, things happen. And to allow you as a healthcare provider to give drugs to treat people and not be able to take care of acute problems that might happen doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make sense. Those 10 states, whatever states they are, to me it's mind-boggling. If you're from one of those states, like my home state, New York, you don't have to be CPR certified. Great. See, all these sick New Yorkers moved to Florida anyway. And in Florida, they require it. So there they die in Florida. That's it. Get them out of the state before they die. Basic life support, doctor, what you should do, because most states mandate CPR for 2 years. I've been a BLS instructor now since 1970s. It's 2 years. The card is good for 2 years. See, that's the problem. The card's good for 2 years. Gee, I've been having chest pain. By the way, I make believe, okay? I make believe I have this disease and that disease. So just, you know, it's cool. I'm okay. All I have are STDs, so there's no problem. I'm interested why you guys know that. This side of the audience is, huh? Did he say what? But I've been teaching CPR since 1973. Now, let's go back to my chest pains. I live in this neighborhood in Los Angeles, and it's a nice little community hospital. And if I had chest pain and I went down to the hospital where my physician is, he might say to me, you know, Stanley, you need a bypass. We can do it here in this hospital. Now, I'm going to ask him, how many have been done in this hospital last year? He said, oh, we did three last year. Okay. I go to the big, I hate to say this, UCLA. Or USC. And I go to the big medical center and I say, how many have you done? 2,000. Who do you think does it better? Who has a higher success rate? Who has a lower morbidity rate? The ones who do it every day. Got it? And if you take CPR every 2 years, you pass the course. And happily, you never need to do this until you need to do it. And it's going to be Thanksgiving, and your family is with you, and dad collapses. And you're the doctor in the family. You're the one who's CPR certified, and you took the course 23 months ago. Gee, I'm involved in a case right now when the paramedics walked in the dental office. It was a cardiac arrest. They were doing CPR, two compressions and one ventilation. That's a hell of a new technique. I never heard of that ever. Did you ever hear of that? Two compressions and one technique, two compressions, one ventilation, and the ventilation wasn't working. And guess what the result was? Dead patient. Well, it doesn't make sense. You've got to do it. Now, I'm not going to make you, I have on here annually. Annually is better than every two years. This is much more likely to happen in your private life than it is in your dental life. Okay, you got to be prepared. If you care. My entire staff, every person who works in my office, I work at dental school. I teach CPR once a month, all faculty, all staff, all students. Different people, I mean, you know, take it. But I come in the building at 5:30 in the morning, and the only persons there are the janitorial? And you know what? If I'm sitting there, and I'm 63 now, if I collapse at my desk, I want them to be CPR certified. Because me, got it? See, I'm very good. I am super good. I'm bragging, but I'm good. I'm a good person to be with if you need help. I'm an anesthesiologist. I maintain airways for a living. I'm good at doing this. I teach CPR. So if you and I are together, you're safe. You got it? My motivation is me. Exactly. Annually. Okay, so BLS. Then we're going to have this emergency team. when we have an emergency in the office, I don't want everybody running around and trying to figure out what to do. We have to have some kind of a design. And here's the design that I worked out. It's really going to be simple. Since every person who works in my dental office is trained in basic life support, the first person there, now let's go through three scenarios. I am Dr. Stanley Malamed treating a patient. My patient has a problem. Okay? This is me, member number one, first person there. I will be Stanley Malamed, registered dental hygienist, treating a patient. My patient has a problem. I, the dental hygienist, am this person. I am Stanley, the receptionist. The grandparent who brought the pediatric patient in, sitting in the waiting room, collapses. All right, I, the receptionist, am now that person. The person who is first on the scene is this person. What do? They stay with the patient. If there's anybody else in the office, if you could scream for help and somebody can hear you, do not leave that person. And yell for help. Now, you know, hospitals, it's Dr. Blue, it's a cardiac arrest code, is a code word, Dr. Heart. In our school, it's Dr. Stat, which S-T-A-T means immediate. Dr. Stat, pediatric dentistry. All right, I need help in the waiting room. That works. Stay with the victim, yell for help, and administer the steps of basic life support that are needed. It might be simply positioning the person properly. It might be positioning the victim and maintaining an airway. It might be positioning, maintaining an airway, and breathing for them. It could be any of these things. That's why this person is the most important. This is the person who is keeping the victim alive, who is ensuring that the victim's brain is receiving a constant supply of blood which contains oxygen. Member number one of that team. It's September, and in my make-believe dental office, Monica's job in the month of September. If there is an emergency in the month of September, Monica, when she hears this call for help, because most people are going to come running to where the emergency is. By the way, that's not always true. There are always a person or two who goes the other way. You know, I don't want to get involved. And hopefully it's not the doctor. Unfortunately. So Monica's job is, before she comes and the emergency is in the reception room, in September her job is to get the stuff. And the stuff is going to be the emergency drug kit, the oxygen cylinder, and if you're really, really, really bright, the AED. By the way, I've been impressed by this because until about a year or two ago, and I would ask an audience like this, and I could be shocked now, how many of you have an AED? The hands were one or two or three. Now, I'm going to try it right now. By the way, an AED, I shouldn't have to define it, because if I have to define it, then you have no clue what it is. An AED is an automated external defibrillator. How many of you own one? Look at this. This is great. God bless you. Fantastic. Now, for the rest of you who don't have one, go down there to the clinic. One of these 30 buildings, Moscone, north, south, west, east. I have no idea where the hell I am. All I know is the speaker's food was not in this building this morning, which really aggravated me. It's over in somewhere in Marin County. I'm not even sure where the hell it is, you know. Take the ferry over, you know. But the point is, they're a company. Look at this. Maybe, what is that, a quarter of the room has AEDs. That's fantastic. It's fantastic. Buy it. That'll be the afternoon. Buy it. Buy two. You know why you're going to buy two? This is part of the afternoon. 70%. We're going to call this out-of-hospital sudden cardiac arrest. Out-of-hospital meaning here, at home, whatever. Out-of-hospital sudden cardiac arrest. 70% occur in the home of the victim. Where do you spend most of your time? Two places, your house and your office. Those are your two homes. Buy two of them. One for there, one for there. Got it? Because the most likely person to need it... That's member number two. Now, once Dr. Malamed comes to the front where the emergency is, I'm going to stand there in shock for a moment because I see a person lying on the floor of my waiting room. And I see my receptionist, Monica, down on her knees, and I see her maintaining an airway, head tilt, chin lift. I go, Monica, what happened? And she mentions how this is the grandparent of the kid, and I say, Monica, I don't care who it is. What happened? Because Monica does that. She likes to embellish on things. So this is the grandparent, and she collapsed. Well, how's she doing? And Monica says, she's breathing, and she has a pulse. And I take a deep breath and say, good, because it's not cardiac arrest. She's breathing and has a pulse. She's not in cardiac arrest. Monica, how long has she been down? About a minute or two. Then I'm saying to myself, okay, it's not a faint. Because if a person fainted and you lay them down, probably within 10 or 15 seconds and definitely within a minute, they'd be responding. So it's not faint, which is would have been good if it was. It's not a cardiac arrest, which is fantastic that it's not. And then my staff starts looking at me and saying, doctor, what's going on? Doctor, what are you going to do about it? I'm standing there going, but this is where I want to go to the parking lot. This is where I want to go in the corner and say, come over here, let's pray. This is where the problem comes in. And I want to do this because I don't really know. I know what it's not. I know it's not a faint. I know it's not cardiac arrest. I have no clue. And as we'll get in here in a moment, if you don't have a clue, get help. Monica's keeping the person alive. She's maintaining an airway. She's breathing on her own. She has a pulse. That's all you have to do. What else can we do? I could say to somebody else, go call 911. I'm on the third floor of a medical dental building. Go down to the lobby of the building. Hey, you know what? How about having the elevator waiting in the lobby? Nothing like waiting, having paramedics wait there for the elevator to come down. Get the elevator in the lobby, have it waiting for you, and you escort the paramedics to the office. Expedite it. We already have the oxygen. We have the emergency kit. We don't need any drugs because I'm not going to give any drugs. I have no idea what's going on. You don't give drugs. But we can give oxygen, can't we? Let's give her some oxygen. This is what you do. You start assigning tasks. See, Dr. Malamud did not say to Monica, get out of the way, let me do it, because Monica is doing a good job. You do not have to be the one who does it. You can delegate these tasks. Keeping in mind that you, the doctor, are the one who is responsible for what Monica is doing in this situation. If she's doing it okay, you can delegate that task. That's what your emergency team is going to be based on. Number 9, and we've been alluding to this, it's getting help. And getting help is so simple. You pick up a phone and you call 911. Period. But I work in a medical dental building and I'm surrounded by all these physicians. Yes, but the physicians who work in a medical dental building, what are they? They're good physicians. They're allergists, they're dermatologists, they're OBGYNs. They're dermatologists, they're psychiatrists. They're not emergency medicine specialists. And remember, only 28 states require them to be CPR certified, where 40 require us. And if you call somebody in and he or she is a physician, and if they don't do it right, your patient died. Your patient died. Got it? So unless you know that that person that you're going to call in is good at handling medical emergencies, then don't. Call in somebody who is. And who is 911. That's what you want to do. All right. Emergency drugs and equipment. Number 10 on the list, least important, but legally you got to have it. Legally, this is the drug package insert from any local anesthetic. It happens to be Cetonest, but it could be, I'll use brand names, it could be Articaine, it could be Septicaine. It's funny, I'm so used to using generic names of drugs, I can't think of brand names anymore. It could be Carbocaine, Polocaine, Scandinest, Isocaine, any local. That little piece of paper, which, by the way, unfolds into a big piece of paper, that has the smallest print in the world, is a medical legal document. And it's amazing because that piece of paper says indication for pain control in dentistry. Then the rest of that 3 pages is all the things that drugs can do that are bad. Keep that in mind, okay? And this is what it says for every one of these drugs under warnings. Dental practitioners who employ local anesthetic agents should be well-versed in the diagnosis and management of emergencies that may arise from their use. What they're saying is stuff happens. It may be due to the drug or it may be due to the act of giving the drug. But then it says resuscitative equipment, oxygen, and other resuscitative drugs should be available for immediate use. It mentions oxygen by name. You have to have oxygen. By the way, I have oxygen here right now at 16%. It's not the best, but it's there. You always got it with you. It says resuscitative equipment. That's the statement that says you need to be able to do CPR. because the equipment for resuscitation is your mouth and your hands and other drugs. It doesn't mention what the names of the drugs are, and be very thankful for that, because when they, they do all that stuff, right? When they make up lists, they make lists that are crazy. They throw everything in, stuff that makes no sense. The problem with not naming drugs is now you know you need to have stuff, but you don't know what stuff you need. So I'm going to go there with you right now. We're going to discuss quickly on the video the bare bones basic kit that every dentist, and we're going to throw into this little group the orthodontist, because technically they are dentists. Hey, look, at my university, everybody wears scrubs except for the orthodontic people who, this is them, because they never come within 10 feet of a patient. There's like a guard all shield between them. They're assistants. Okay, assistant, go over there and twist it a little bit more, you know? See, our school gives them a DDS and an MBA, because that's what they need. Money just rolls right in, you know? See, I'm not picking on them. I'm just jealous. They never get their fingers wet. We don't get fingers wet. We wear gloves. I know. But the bare bones basic kit. Now, the bare bones basic kit has, I've been doing this again for a long time, and it's changed over the years dramatically. When I first wrote my book back in 1978, there were 15 drugs in this bare bones basic kit, and it's changed. I realize that virtually all of us in the room, and I don't mean to pick on my profession, but we don't start IVs every day. In fact, I know that one of my students, Mike's students, is here, and I know that back in 19, she graduated in 1991, back a long time ago, she did a venipuncture in her second year of dental school on one of her classmates. And that's it. It's been 20 years. And if I have a drug in the emergency kit, by the way, the drug is an anticonvulsant, you give it during a seizure to stop a seizure. How on earth are you going to start an IV for the first time in 20 years on a person who's seizing? It's not going to happen. So the kit changed as I became more aware of our... I'm one of us, but I see, as an anesthesiologist, I start IVs all the time. So I had this bias. You don't need that drug. Get it out of the kit. 7 drugs. Epi 1 to 1,000, histamine blocker, injectable. The only 2 injectable drugs in the emergency kit are both used for allergy. We have a bunch of non-injectables. The video will go over this. And we have a very important piece of equipment, which is the automated external defibrillator. So here's a little video to discuss this. There are 7 drugs in the bare bones basic emergency kit, 2 injectable drugs and 5 non-injectable. The single most important drug in emergency medicine is epinephrine. Epinephrine must be available in a preloaded syringe. This is the EpiPen, which contains 1 dose of epinephrine. Epinephrine is used in the anaphylactic reaction. It is a 1 in 1,000 concentration. In the anaphylactic reaction, it is very, very common to use more than 1 dose. So for that reason, we recommend strongly that in addition to having 1 preloaded syringe, the doctor have in the emergency kit minimally 2 or 3 1 milliliter glass ampules of epinephrine 1 to 1,000. The second injectable drug in the emergency kit is a histamine blocker. Diphenhydramine, or Benadryl, is the one that is most commonly used in emergency drug kits. Histamine blockers are used in management of the allergic reaction. However, it is used in the non-life-threatening allergic reaction primarily. Histamine blockers are also used in the anaphylactic reaction after epinephrine has saved the person's life. There are no contraindications to the administration of a histamine blocker during a medical emergency. There are 5 non-injectable drugs in the emergency kit. A vasodilator must be included. This drug is nitroglycerin. 1 spray is equivalent to 1 sublingual tablet. The spray is sprayed on the patient's tongue, translingual application of nitroglycerin. Another non-injectable drug is the bronchodilator. The bronchodilator is used to treat bronchospasm. Bronchospasm is the acute asthmatic attack. The most commonly used drug in America is a drug called albuterol. The 2 brand names of this drug are Ventolin and Proventil. The medication comes in an inhaler, and the patient, after placing it in their mouth, as they inhale, will simply compress the spray, and the medication is inhaled into their lung. Another drug for the emergency kit is sugar. Now, sugar can be made available either in a tube, this is called Instaglucose, or you can simply have a bottle of orange juice or non-diet soft drink in the refrigerator. Hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, is a very common situation, emergency in a dental office, and is easily managed if sugar is available. The most recent addition to the emergency kit is aspirin. Aspirin is part of the pre-hospital treatment of suspected heart attack victims. One aspirin tablet, 325 milligrams. The last of our seven drugs is also the second most important drug in emergency medicine, and that drug is oxygen. Oxygen must be available in an E cylinder. Okay. And the AED, automated external defibrillator, which right now is mandated in the state of Florida. Now, I hope there's nobody here from Iowa. There are two states that mandate that require AEDs. Florida was the first. And you understand Florida makes sense. Okay? Makes sense. My whole family is down there. They moved from New York, and that's where they go to die. It's the elephant's burial ground for New Yorkers. They made this requirement that as of February 28th of last year, 2006, any dental office not having an AED on site, you're practicing below standard of care. Florida. Now, you know, if 40 states require CPR for licensure and defibrillation is part of basic life support, I don't understand the other 39 states. In other words, you need to have a CPR card. You've taken this course, and part of the course is defibrillation, but they allow you then to practice without having a defibrillator. The other state was Iowa, but they didn't technically pass it, but both dentists bought AEDs. So, you know, if you're from Iowa, I'm sorry, you know, but I'm really sorry you're from Iowa, but this is something I want to mention to you that is I'm involved with in an offhanded way in the sense that people come to me with ideas about how can we foster, for them, how do you make money, essentially, but how can we help the dental profession? And there's a group that now has, it's almost like they will come into your house and reorganize your closets for you. You know, they'll help you organize your dental office to handle medical emergencies. And I'm not sure if they're here at the convention. They might be, but the original name was the Red E, Ready. And it's basically, it's books and things that help you organize your staff in your office to handle the problems that might arise. Okay, we're prepared. Basic life support and emergency team. We're not going to be afraid to call 911, and we have the emergency drugs and equipment. Now we have to recognize the fact that something is wrong, and we do this based upon signs and symptoms. Now, there are a couple of emergencies that are really, really easy. The patient is lying in your chair. The patient pushes your hand away and sits up. And you go, John, what's the matter? And John goes, I'm having an asthmatic attack. John's asthmatic. John is asthmatic. You know he's asthmatic. And he comes to the office with his inhaler. And when he has an asthmatic attack, he sits himself up. Why does he sit up? Because I can breathe better. And he simply medicates himself, and it's over. That's an easy emergency. And the other one that's easy is angina. The patient's lying in the chair. They have a history of angina. And they push your hand away. And they sit up and you say, what's the matter, John? Just poor John's got everything. And by the way, John also has STDs. You know that, yeah? Because he's a John, okay? That was too easy. That was just too easy. But the patient with angina simply takes their nitroglycerin and it's over. And that's why there are some emergencies that are really easy to recognize. But there are others that are not. I mean, if a person has never had chest pain before, they're not going to say, I'm having an anginal attack. They're going to be scared to death and say, I'm having the big one. They don't know what it is. This is the first time it's ever happened. A patient who's having difficulty breathing, it doesn't have to only be asthma. There are other things that can happen. So the first thing you do is recognize that something is wrong. You stop doing dentistry. I mean, is this obvious? Because it's not obvious to everybody, and I've been involved in cases, and it's hard to understand how a patient could have a seizure, and the doctor kept on working, and the patient died. Doctor, what did you do when the seizure started? I finished the filling. Yes, I can't make those things up. I could make them up, but I didn't make it up. It's crazy. You stop what you're doing, and then you treat it. So now here we are, July 1st of 2007 in San Francisco General Hospital. Let me go up on my podium, and I'm the chairman of emergency medicine at the hospital. You are my new residents in emergency medicine. Okay, we're going to be on the show ER. Doctors, this is the way in our hospital here in San Francisco, this is the way you will treat medical emergencies in this emergency room. PABCD. And the same lecture is being given in Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit. Montefiore, my hospital back in the Bronx, New York, is being given everywhere on July 1st to the new residents because this is the way you treat a medical emergency. It doesn't matter whether you are a physician or a paramedic or a nurse or a dentist. It doesn't matter. This is the way you treat a medical emergency, any medical emergency. P stands for positioning. If that doctor in California had simply taken that patient who fainted and laid her down, placed her in a supine position, would have been over. They would have woken up, would have been fine. Proper positioning is the first thing you have to do. Airway, you have to assess the airway. By the way, this is what you do for every medical emergency, not just when you're unconscious. Whoever's in the back of the room, the last row of this room, I'm going to ask you, can you tell me if my airway is open from where you're sitting? Is my airway open? Am I breathing? And is my heart beating? The answer is yes. Number one, the fact that I'm blowing out all this hot air. Okay, I'm speech, my airway's open, I'm breathing. And the fact that I'm conscious means my heart, my pump is pumping blood to my brain. The moment a patient says to you, doctor, I'm dying, you've assessed their airway, you've assessed their breathing, you've assessed their circulation, and they're okay. It's that simple. Doctor, I can't breathe. You're a liar. Because if they say to you they can't breathe, they're breathing. You know, you understand the universal sign for choking. Okay? Positioning, airway, breathing, circulation. And because we are doctors, we have one more obligation. It's not just to keep them alive. It's to try to figure out what is wrong. And if we know what's wrong, then go ahead and treat it. So let me show you this on video. Basic management of emergencies.
All medical emergencies are managed in basically the same way. The algorithm for treating all medical emergencies is PABCD. P stands for positioning the patient. A is airway, B is breathing, C is circulation, and D is definitive care. The first step in managing all medical emergencies is positioning the patient properly. For a conscious person having a medical emergency, the position of choice is whatever is most comfortable for that person. For example, an asthmatic, somebody having difficulty breathing, is going to want to sit up. That is perfectly okay in a conscious patient. Somebody suffering from chest pain, where the feeling they have is that of a heavy weight on their chest, would most often want to sit up. As long as the patient retains consciousness, any position they want is acceptable. In the unconscious patient, the position of choice is supine. Supine is horizontal with the feet elevated slightly. The most common reason that a human being loses consciousness is low blood pressure. And that's why the supine position is the ideal position. When the head and heart are parallel to the floor, the blood flow to the brain is increased. The patient can still breathe adequately in the supine position. We don't want you to put the patient who is unconscious in a head lower than heart position. That elevates the blood flow to the brain, but it also prevents breathing from being effective. So the ideal position for all unconscious patients is horizontal or supine with the feet elevated slightly. The second step in managing emergencies is airway. Now, in a conscious patient, and especially if a conscious patient can talk to you, we know the airway is open. We know they're breathing. Speech is breathing. And because they're conscious, we know the heart is beating. So in the conscious victim of a medical emergency, the moment they speak to you, we have assessed the airway. We have assessed their breathing. We've assessed the circulation. Just by listening to them, we know the airway is open. We know they're breathing. We know the heart, the pump, is still beating. So we don't have to physically do anything for A, B, or C in the conscious patient. However, when a person is unconscious, their muscles relax. The tongue, being a muscle, falls backwards into the airway. Gravity does this. And the airway of most unconscious persons is either totally obstructed or partially obstructed. Airway management is critically important in saving the life of any unconscious victim. The technique for maintaining an airway in the unconscious patient is very simple. It is called head tilt chin lift, where one hand is placed on the patient's forehead, two fingers placed under the jaw, and you simply rotate the head back. Since the tongue is attached to the mandible, and if we lift the mandible, the tongue is lifted off the airway. The next step in the unconscious patient is to check and see if they are breathing. Now, breathing is defined as the exchange of air. Air going in, air going out. Head tilt chin lift is maintained. The rescuer has to place his or her ear 1 inch away, 1 inch away from the victim's mouth and nose, looking at the victim's chest to see if the patient is trying to breathe. Very important concept. Seeing the person's chest moving does not mean they're breathing. The airway could still be obstructed, but the patient will still attempt to breathe. The body does this automatically. Seeing the chest move does not mean the patient is breathing. That's why you have to put your ear 1 inch away from the victim's mouth and nose to feel it, to hear it. If you feel air, if you hear air coming out of the victim's mouth and nose, then the airway is open and they are breathing. If the chest is not moving, the victim is not breathing. That's called apnea. The rescuer has to deliver 2 complete full ventilations to deliver oxygen to the victim's lungs. After doing that, we now have gotten oxygen into the patient's blood. The next step, C, circulation, is that blood which contains oxygen going to the patient's brain. Maintaining head tilt, we then check the carotid artery. It is absolutely important that the doctor or any healthcare provider know how to locate the carotid artery. Studies have recently shown that in paramedics and physicians, up to 40% of the time, they misdiagnose the carotid pulse. They put their finger where they think the artery is supposed to be, and it's not. So when there is a pulse, they think there isn't, and they start doing chest compression. Or when there is no pulse, they think there is. So it's very, very important for the healthcare provider to know how to locate the carotid artery. To locate the carotid artery, while maintaining head tilt with one hand, the index and middle fingers of the opposite hand are placed on the Adam's apple, the thyroid cartilage, and slide down along the neck towards the rescuer until the fingers fall into a groove formed by the sternocleidomastoid muscle. The carotid artery is located in that groove. The carotid pulse is palpated for 10 seconds, no more. If the pulse is not present, then you start doing chest compressions. You are now circulating blood, which contains oxygen, to the victim's brain. The last step in our managing of medical emergencies is D, definitive care. The first 4 steps, positioning, airway, breathing, and circulation, are basic life support. We are now ensuring that the victim's brain is receiving a constant supply of blood which contains oxygen. We're keeping the victim alive. D, definitive care. What's wrong? What's the problem? We're keeping him alive, PABC. What's the problem? D stands for diagnosis. If the doctor can diagnose the problem, and if the doctor has the appropriate drugs and equipment, then treat it. If you cannot diagnose it, then call 911. If you can diagnose it and don't like what's going on, also call 911. Remember that your legal obligation during a medical emergency is to keep the patient alive until either they recover or until somebody comes on the scene who is better trained than you are and takes over.
He's a wise man. So we are, the preparation part of this is done. And we're going to start now going through specific emergencies and treating them. But before we do so, we have to pay the rent here, we have to do commercials. So I have a commercial. You need to watch this. Okay, so our first problem is altered consciousness. We're dealing with the brain for a little bit here, and I want to discuss actually two things with you: low blood sugar and seizures. Lots of reasons in a dental environment for a patient. See, what we're dealing with primarily is a conscious person who simply is not acting the way they normally do. There's something different about that person. They're not unconscious. They're conscious, but behaving weirdly. And let's just, go right down here and discuss the major thing is going to be low blood sugar. Now, let's talk about the brain. The brain, when it comes to your body's weight, is only 2% of your body's total weight. 2%. Where skeletal muscle is about half of your body's weight. To keep the muscle functioning normally, every time your heart contracts, 15% of the blood pumped out of the heart satisfies the needs of all the muscle. The brain is only 2% of your body's weight, and yet just about the same amount of blood is needed to keep the brain functioning. The brain needs a constant supply of blood, and that blood contains what are called substrates, fuel. The fuel is sugar, the fuel is oxygen. The most common reason a human being loses consciousness is a drop in blood pressure. If there's less blood flowing to the brain, there's less oxygen, there's less sugar, the brain can't function, it shuts off and the patient's unconscious. Simple. What we're dealing with right now was the number 9 most common medical emergency, low blood sugar. Low blood sugar. The patient's blood pressure is normal. They're getting oxygen. There's simply not enough sugar in that patient's blood. And the brain is functioning, but it simply cannot function normally. Hypoglycemia. Anyone can become hypoglycemic. Anybody can. Just go on a diet, miss a meal or two, or over-exercise. It can happen. But the most likely person to become hypoglycemic is a person who takes a drug, insulin, that lowers blood sugar. And the reason that person's a diabetic, and the reason they take that drug is because diabetics have high blood sugar. They're hyperglycemic. And hyperglycemia is not conducive to longevity. You die sooner. You die from renal problems, kidney problems, from cardiac problems. You die. So you take insulin on a regular basis, anywhere from twice a day to 6 times a day, and you lower your blood sugar. But any time you take a drug which lowers blood sugar, there's always the risk of lowering it too far. Very simple. Hypoglycemia, the most likely diabetic-related medical emergency in a diabetic. High blood, by the way, let me just quickly eliminate this one as a possibility. Hyperglycemia, high blood sugar, as an acute medical emergency in dentistry, probably has never happened and likely never will. Just go to Ghirardelli or Ghirardelli. I had a big argument with one of my students a couple of years ago. Is it a soft G or a hard G? Ghirardelli or Ghirardelli. Go down there, get a double hot fudge sundae tonight. You're going to be hyperglycemic. Then go back to the hotel, buy some Ben and Jerry's. And guess what? You're fine. Hyperglycemia ain't a problem. It's not. Low blood sugar can kill you real fast. So, in comes your patient. We know they're diabetic. I'm not going to go into type 1 versus type 2. We know they're diabetic. The most common cause of low blood sugar amongst diabetics is not taking too much insulin. It's taking insulin and then not eating. Because insulin low, if you had breakfast this morning 2.5-3 hours ago, your blood sugar level is coming down to fairly normal levels. If you took insulin right now and didn't eat, guess what? It lowers it. And if it starts out as being normal, you become hypoglycemic. So this, but diabetics understand this, and they take their insulin, which takes 20 minutes to work, and then they go to the kitchen and eat breakfast, eat lunch, eat dinner. But this diabetic takes their insulin and goes to the fridge to eat breakfast and sees the postcard that we sent them. It says, just a reminder. You understand the postcard? And they look at their watch, my God, the appointment's in 10 minutes. I totally forgot. And instead of eating, gets in the car and comes to the office. That's how this happens. They simply forget to eat. They took their insulin and they forgot to eat. That patient comes into your office, and you, any person who's a diabetic, now you're the receptionist, you're the assistant, you're the hygienist, you're the doctor, whoever sees the patient first, you know they're diabetic. It's marked on the inside of their chart because you can't mark it on the outside of the chart because it's privileged information. When did you last take your insulin? When did you last eat? And if the patient says, I took my insulin but didn't eat, then you know what? How about some prophylactic medicine? How about offering them a glass of orange juice before you have a problem, before you start treatment? See, if you have a problem in the middle of treatment, the patient's acting weird and gets kind of aggressive, and you got to fight to get orange juice in, and you've wasted 20, 30 minutes perhaps, why not give them orange juice straight up front? This way you won't have a problem. Ask that question. Very, very simple, okay? Classically, hypoglycemia, cold, sweating, shaking, and mentally disoriented. Now, that's not, see, it's classically. But unfortunately, there are people who don't follow the rules, and they have weird things happen to them. So why not, when your patient first comes to your dental office and they fill out their medical history and it says they're diabetic, you ask them, when you become hypoglycemic, what happens? So this way you're going to get their specific signs. And I met a dentist who himself is diabetic, and he's a very laid-back, type 2 person. And his staff said when the middle of the afternoon, if we notice the doctor starting to talk a lot, we stop him, we bring him in the back, we smack him around a little bit, we give him some orange juice, and he's fine. But he begins to get more outgoing. He begins to talk a lot, and the staff knows that that's not good. Okay, this is not our doctor. He's changing. Change in personality is the first thing you normally see. So find out from that patient what their signs and symptoms might be. These are the classical signs and symptoms. So you're going to see this slide a number of other times in the next hour. We have about an hour left. And the person comes into the office, they've taken their insulin, they sit in your dental chair, and things are going along fairly well. They're lying down in the chair. Most of us recline patients. And the patient abruptly pushes your hand away and sits up and starts saying, I got to get out of here. I got to go home. I just don't want to be here anymore. And you notice they're sweating. The first thing you notice is going to be this change in personality, and the patients get a little bit more aggressive. Let's go through this scenario. Positioning in a conscious patient in a medical emergency, position is based upon patient comfort. So any position the patient wants is okay. Airway breathing and circulation need not be done because the person is talking to you. I want to go home. A, B, and C are okay. Definitive care in this diabetic who's acting weirdly is going to give them sugar. Give them sugar. Now, sugar, again, is going to be it could be orange juice or a non-diet soft drink. One of the things you ought to do also, in addition to asking your patient, what are your signs and symptoms, when you become hypoglycemic, what works the best for you? And you'll hear orange juice 9 out of 10 times. Okay? Non-diet soft drink. You know what the problem with that is? It's not going to be in the emergency kit. It's going to be in the refrigerator. And that's the problem, because it's not going to be there. Get the orange juice. Hey, Doc, it's not there. What do you mean it's not there? Well, remember yesterday when you were thirsty at 3 o'clock? Seriously, that's going to be the problem. If I see a can of soft drink or orange juice and I'm thirsty, I'm drinking. I don't care. It's an emergency kit. Now, if you put a radiation sticker on it or something like that, that would work. But that's why we mentioned on the video you put a tube of this medical glucose in there, because that'll be there. But again, orange juice is normally the thing. What I would do is give the patient a 12-ounce bottle. I'd give them 4 ounces. And the first 4 ounces might be difficult to get in because you're a little bit not friendly, not a little combative. You wait 5 minutes, and you give the next 4 ounces, which should be pretty easy. And then you wait 5 minutes. The total time here is 10 minutes. And by the time you give that last 4 ounces, they're fine. And what's going to be scary about this is the patient's going to look at you and say, Dr. Malamed? How did I get here? And I've heard that from patients many, many times. When your brain is not functioning normally due to lack of sugar, you're amnesic. That person drove in their car to come to your office and they have no memory of it. That's a little bit scary. So that's what's going to happen. Here's a video of the same thing.
Okay.
You're busy. You're working on the patient. And probably 15 minutes into your dental treatment, the patient has changed. They're no longer the same person they were before. They were a nice, quiet individual. And now they're almost ranting. Now they're just, they have to leave the chair. They want to go home. Mental confusion, mental disorientation is one of the first signs you see in low blood sugar. The administration of sugar. Now, sugar can be the gel. Sugar can be orange juice. Sugar can be a non-diet soft drink. If we have orange juice or a soft drink, give the patient 4 ounces. Wait about 5 minutes. Give them 4 ounces more.
How did I get here?
You drove here.
You're kidding.
No, you actually drove here.
I can't believe that.
Did you eat breakfast this morning after you took your insulin?
No, didn't do it. I was in a hurry. Obviously, I was in a hurry to get in the car, but I don't remember getting here.
Well, at least you got here fine without any accident.
Yeah.
Okay, so I got one that's a little bit better. This one is the movie Steel Magnolias. The wonderful and luscious. If she walked in the back room and said, "Stanley, come with me," I'd say goodbye. There's no chance in hell it's going to happen, but at least, you know, it's what keeps me going. I figure if Lyle Lovett got there, there's a chance for anybody. You need this. You need this, the carrot. You know, you need that. In this movie, Julia Roberts is, we don't know it at the time, but she has diabetes. And she's getting married soon, and she's in a beauty parlor with all these famous lady actors. By the way, I'm from California. We don't call them actresses now, they're actors. So they're female actors. Okay, that's the new thing. You don't dare call, you know, them an actress anymore. But she you'll see her going through this hypoglycemic episode.
So sick. Just because I'm bragging on you don't mean you can get lazy on me. Hold your head up, Shelby. Shelby? Shelby! My man!
I'll get some juice.
Truby, there's some candy in my purse.
I have some.
Shelby, Shelby, hold on. Clary's getting you some juice. Shelby, Shelby, Shelby.
Should I get her a cookie?
No, juice is better.
Here's the juice.
Shelby, Shelby, you need some juice. You need some juice.
Stop it, Mama.
Drink the juice.
Please drink the juice.
No! Stop it, Mama. In my purse.
No, you didn't bring your purse, sweetheart. You didn't bring your purse. No, you didn't. No, here you go.
No.
There you go. Drink some of this. It's not any wonder with all this running around and wet nonsense.
Excuse me, should I call the doctor or something?
No.
She's a diabetic.
She just has a little too much insulin, that's all. We'll just get a little more in her, she'll be all right.
Don't leave me alone. I'm going to leave.
Oh, I'd love to see you try. Cooperate, please.
Honey, drink, please.
Come on now. There, girl. Yes, 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 yes. There you go. There you go. There, 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 there. There. That's a start.
This one hit her fast.
She's been so upset lately. Mitchell told her on her last appointment. Children aren't possible.
Don't talk about me like I'm not here.
Oh, she's making some sense now. Yes, she is. This one was not bad at all. It was not bad at all.
I'm sorry the sound was low, but it's amazing. I look at these people. This is easily 20 years old. Dolly Parton has not aged. It's absolutely amazing. You look at a photograph of her now. I guess it's living in the mountains in Tennessee or something. I don't know what it is, but she has not aged in the slightest. Okay. Patient gets up in the morning. They're diabetic. They go to the bathroom. They sample their blood sugar. They take their insulin. Insulin takes about a half an hour, 20 minutes, 30 minutes to work. They go to the kitchen to have breakfast, but the postcard is there. Oh, my God, my dental appointment, and I'll never miss a dental appointment. So they get in their car and they come to you, but they get stuck in traffic. So it takes them a little bit longer to get there. And now when they get to the dental office, the assistant places the patient in a chair. Of course, when you come in late, you know, the doctor's going to be late. So the patient's placed in a chair. Monica, what I want you to do, I want you now to fall asleep. Just put your head down. Okay. So I walk into the room. Now, Monica is this patient. And Monica, by the way, is a normal, healthy person. And she's my 7:30 patient in the morning. And you know, it's early in the morning. And I understand how if I walk in, the patient may be sitting in a chair and just may fall asleep. So, Monica, you are sleeping. I walk in the room. Now, if you walk in the room and see a patient sitting in your chair like that, you don't walk in and go, Monica, Monica, you all right? You assume she's sleeping. Look, every dad, your dad and you, if you're a dad, has his chair. Dad has his chair. Right? And when you walk in your house, when your dad is in that chair, what is your dad doing in that chair? Sleeping. Okay. Monica is my patient at 7:30. I walk into the room. I see Monica looking like a little angel. And I walk over to her and I simply wake her up. And I go like that. Hey, Monica. And she wakes up. Okay? I must have dozed. This is the reality in your dental chair of shake and shout. Because you're not going to assume, unless she's lying there in a weird position, you're not going to assume that she's dead. You're assuming she's sleeping. So you gently tap her on the shoulder. And if she doesn't respond to a gentle tap, you're going to be a little bit louder and a little bit more aggressive. So now you're unconscious. Now she is unconscious. How do I know? I don't know. She looks like she's sleeping. This Monica must have one hell of a nightlife, because every time I see Monica, she's fast asleep. And I walk over and I simply tap her on the shoulder the way I did before, and there's no response. I do it again a little bit more vigorously, and there's no response. Monica, Monica, you all right? And there's no response. Okay, you're okay now. Okay. So she's unconscious. What's the most likely reason for a human being unconscious? Low blood pressure. So the first thing I will do with my unconscious patient is lay her down flat. Increase the blood flow to the brain. And we do that. And I do head tilt, chin lift. And I do look, listen, and feel. And I hear her breathing. She's breathing beautifully. And I check her pulse, and she got a fantastic pulse. I make believe, you know, time-wise, but it's been 10, 15, 20, 30 seconds. You know what? If Monica had fainted 20, 30 seconds, she'd be back. She's not. By the way, my staff has all come running in the room. Doctor, doctor, what's going on? What can we do? I'm saying, saying to myself, she's unconscious for a minute, almost 2 minutes, going on three. By the way, here's an interesting question for you. How long will you, with that patient of yours, in the chair, unconscious, breathing and has a pulse, how long will you stand there and hope she gets better? When you understand that a person who fainted usually recovers consciousness in about 10 or 15 seconds. Once you position them properly, 10 or 15 seconds, you know what? I'm going to be honest with you. If it's a minute, I'm calling 911. Why am I calling 911? Because I don't know what's going on. I know two things it's not. It's not fainting. It's not cardiac arrest. I have no clue. Monica's a brand new patient in the office. Haven't filled out the history. I don't know. I'm going to call 911. They're going to come to the office, and they're going to take over. Remember, I'm going to keep her alive, maintain an airway until they show up. Now, they're going to walk in the room and say, hey, doc, what's going on? And they do, by the way. They walk in and say, hey, doc, what's going on? Well, we have an unconscious patient. We have no medical history. She's been unconscious now for about 8-9 minutes. Her blood pressure, by the way, is 120 over 80, and she's breathing. And the paramedic says to him or herself, it's not cardiac arrest. It's not fainting. It's not the number one most common reason for losing consciousness. It's not low blood pressure. Her blood pressure is 120 over 80. Okay, so now let's think like a paramedic. If her brain is getting blood and the blood contains oxygen and sugar, she should be conscious again. But she has an airway, so the blood contains oxygen. It may not contain enough sugar. Now, not knowing her medical history, she has no medical history yet. We haven't taken it. The paramedic, their job is to stabilize the victim and transport to the hospital if needed. They're going to start an IV on her. They're going to hook up a bag of dextrose and water, 5% dextrose, just to keep, or normal saline to keep the vein open, and take out a syringe. a 30cc syringe of dextrose 50%, 5-0. Now, it has the viscosity of corn syrup, and it's 30cc's. So you're going to take that in the syringe. You know what it is? It's a Ben and Jerry's Hot Fudge Sundae being given intravenously. Seriously. And they're going to sit there, and since it's so viscous, it's not easy to push. And they're going to sit there and push it in, and in about 2 or 3 minutes, because it takes a drug to go from here, the hand where you put the IV in, to the brain. What's called hand-heart-brain circulation time is about 20 seconds. And in about 20 seconds or 30 seconds or 40 seconds, she will begin, if she is hypoglycemic, she'll begin to recover. And in our scenario, she is. Now, what if she's not? She doesn't get better. She stays the same. She's still unconscious with the blood pressure and she's breathing. They've eliminated now the number one and number two most likely causes of being unconscious. Low blood pressure, low blood sugar. Number three, we don't have a clue. Those are the two things that stand out far and away, the two most common things causing unconsciousness. Low blood pressure, low blood sugar. After they've eliminated those two, they will take her to the hospital. They'll do blood tests. They'll do CAT scans. They'll try to figure out what's going on. Okay, we didn't know her history, but now we do. We know that Monica is a diabetic. We know that. She's been our patient for years. And the same exact thing just happened. She is not responsive. So here's what Dr. Malamud is going to do. I'm going to position Monica supine because she's unconscious. The assumption is low blood pressure. Head tilt, chin lift, look, listen, and feel. Monica is breathing. I check Monica's pulse. She's got a pulse. Everything's exactly the same. Got it? And I say, hey, Monica is a diabetic. In fact, Monica is a smart diabetic because Monica is wearing a Medic Alert bracelet that says, I'm a diabetic. And that's an important thing to have because she can't tell me she's unconscious. So I know Monica is a diabetic. I'm Dr. You, okay? Because there is probably a Dr. You in the audience, but Dr. You. Is there a Dr. YU in the room? No? Okay. There should be. I don't want to go there. See, I don't have the time to do that. I love playing the game, so I'm not going to do it. I know she's diabetic. I'm one of you. Haven't done an IV since dental school. If then, what am I going to do? 911. Now the paramedics walk in. Hey, doc, what's going on? We have an unconscious diabetic. Her blood pressure is 120 over 80. Ah, the paramedic is saying, hey, it's not low blood pressure. She's a diabetic. It must be low blood sugar. And what are they going to do? Start an IV and give the same exact drug. In other words, they would do nothing different. Knowing she's diabetic and or not knowing she's diabetic, they will still do the same thing. But they'll give her the sugar feeling more secure in that it's going to work. Got it. That's it. You saved her life. You simply did airway. You positioned her properly. You maintained her airway, and that's all you had to do. Very, very simple. Please do not put anything in her mouth. Anything. Do not put, let's give her some orange juice. She's unconscious, folks. The cause of death is drowning. Don't take decorative cake icing, as Dr. Malamud used to discuss. Decorative cake icing and rub it on the patient's gingiva. If you do it right, it works in 40 minutes. And if you can call 911 and have them there in under 40 minutes, don't do it. But the reason I went away from this decorative cake icing was very, very simply topical anesthetics. I love topicals. I think they're the greatest things in the world for helping you to make injections. See, if whether or not you think they work is irrelevant. If you use topical, you're trying to make injections better, which means you're going to give injections slowly, and that's the answer to giving painless local anesthetics, is slow. Everything else helps, but slow. Okay, I love pina colada, and we got pina colada flavored topical, but I have a problem. When my student is going to give an injection in the maxilla, tooth number 4, they take that cotton swab with pina colada flavored topical, and they put it up there. I got an A in anatomy. How on earth does a patient say to me, pina colada, good. Where the heck are the taste buds? There are no taste buds in the buccal fold in the maxilla. The taste buds are on the tongue. Do you understand what just happened? That gel liquefied ran onto the patient's tongue. That's how they tasted it. That patient is conscious. They can swallow. If you take this and put too much on, the same thing's going to happen. It's going to liquefy. Remember, they're lying on their back. It's going to run into the back of their throat, and this person cannot swallow. That's the danger. It takes a long time to work, and if you put too much on, it's not good. So if you can get help available in 40 minutes, and I'm hoping that would be the case in virtually all your situations, don't do that. Just simply keep the patient alive, maintain the airway, and call 911. So the next logical thing, and this sounds kind of weird, but the next logical thing to discuss is seizures for a very simple reason. Seizures happen when brain cells begin to die. And brain cells begin to die due to lack of oxygen and lack of sugar. I'm a runner, and I go out, and once in a while, I'm kind of klutzy when I go running. I was running down by the bridge this morning. The fog was great. The top of the bridge was not in the fog, and the actual running, the roadway was in fog. It was the most gorgeous thing in the world. But I'm the kind of person who, when I'm running, if there's a little pebble that big, I'll trip on it. And I've fallen down, and I actually have scars on my knees, but you know, I fall down, I scrape my knee, and the next morning I have a scab. And the scab is dead. So if you could touch the scab, it doesn't hurt. But surrounding the scab is an area of red skin, and that's damaged skin. And that's the part that hurts. My grandkids call this the owie. Okay, you touch it, and it's hurt. Skin that is damaged, skin that is that is dying, becomes hyperexcitable, and it hurts. In the brain, when brain cells are damaged, they get hyperexcitable. And when brain cells are hyperexcitable, they depolarize prematurely, and that's what leads to seizures. There's an area, if a patient has epilepsy, it simply means that this person has suffered more than one seizure in their life from unknown reasons. There are known reasons. Overdose of local anesthesia in dentistry or medicine. Cocaine overdose is a seizure. Anoxia during childbirth. A brain tumor. There are a lot of falling down and hitting your head hard against something. Anything that damages brain cells can lead to seizures. And if you have two seizures for unknown reasons, none of the things I mentioned, you are by definition epileptic. Two idiopathic seizures in your life. As our Chief Justice Roberts is now an epileptic because he's had more than one seizure. So, what we're looking at here is an area in this person's brain. By the way, most victims of seizures, when they have a seizure, you're going to go to the hospital, you're going to be evaluated. The most common etiology for seizures is called idiopathic. Idiopathic means we know what it's not. It's not this, 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 or this. What is it? We don't know. Idiopathic. That's the most common etiology, if you want. In other words, we don't know the etiology. So there's an area in this patient's brain where there are damaged neurons. They're hyperexcitable, and they just fire off. And when they fire off, they will stimulate the surrounding neurons. And essentially, the entire brain is short-circuiting. The victim falls to the ground. The victim arches their back. The victim convulses. That's what is called the grand mal seizure, the real name of which is a generalized tonic-clonic seizure. In dentistry, there are a number of reasons for this happening. The most likely reason is the person who's epileptic. An epileptic patient taking whatever medications they take to prevent seizures, anti-epileptic drugs. And you know what? In a stressful environment, epileptics have seizures. You know, and then Dr. Malamud, don't take this personally, blah, 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 but I hate dentists. Sedation prevents it. A patient who faints, a healthy person who faints, 15, 18-year-old guy, macho dude who faints, and you don't lay him down fast enough, or you lay him down but don't maintain his airway. If his brain is not getting enough oxygen, you're going to see a seizure. Hypoglycemia, the one you just saw earlier. Lots of reasons. See, in our dental office, you do not really care at that moment when the seizure starts. You don't care why it's happening. You've got to handle the problem, and the problem is the seizure. So what we need to do very simply... Oh, by the way, let's go back to the epileptic patient now. This slide deals with the epileptic patient. They're the one who's most likely to have a seizure. John, you find out what medications you're taking, you find out how well the drugs are working, and then you ask the patient, What is your aura? A-U-R-A. The aura is when a seizure starts. It always starts in that one spot where the neurons are damaged. And let's say in me, that is the visual cortex of my brain. So I'm standing here, I'm walking around, and I see rainbows. And they're vivid rainbows. Uh-oh, my seizure has started. Those neurons are firing off. Now, if I were standing up here on the podium, and I have my aura, and I ignored it because I want you to get the full benefit of this 2.5 hours, I would stand here, and next thing would happen to me is I would fall to the ground unconscious. I could get killed. I'm on a stairs. I could fall down and break my neck. The aura, my aura, lasts for about 30 seconds. So I have time to get off the stage, lie down here, away from tables, away from chairs, on my back, and I have my seizure. And then eventually I will become aware of what's going on around me, and I'll, by the way, by that time the room is totally empty, you're gone, you know. I say, okay, why am I lying on the ground in the middle of this empty room? Oh, I must have had a seizure. And I'll look at my watch and go to my next lecture over at Moscone, South, East, North, and West. That's it. See, the aura gives the victim a chance to protect themselves. It tells them the seizure has begun. Again, so find out what their aura is. It could be a sound. It could be a maybe the arm begins to twitch, but it's the same all the time. Find out what their aura is and get out of their mouth. Get out of that patient's mouth. Leave the person in the chair. You know, this is nice carpeting. It's better than concrete. But a dental chair is not a bad place. You know, we don't have carpets anymore in dental offices because of all these things that grow in them. Now, seizures. Generalized tonic-clonic seizure is the grand mal seizure. By far the most common type of seizure. It is the one that is the most life-threatening. Grand mal is the lay term. Generalized. Generalized means the entire brain. Tonic is that period of muscle rigidity. Clonic is what you and I think of as the actual seizure, when the arms and legs are moving around varying degrees. Generalized tonic-clonic seizure. They stop, and that's so important. That's why I took out that anticonvulsant. First of all, the anticonvulsant drug had to be given intravenously. It made no sense unless you're trained in it. You know, again, it's not a knock on our profession. There's no reason for us to be trained in venipuncture. Unless you're doing IV sedation, there's no reason. It would be nice to learn, but it's not one of the things you need. Seizures stop. So you don't need to give drugs intravenously here. Most seizures last a minute. And you know what? If I were to ask you how many of you have seen seizures, a lot of hands would go up. And you know what? A minute. It was the longest minute of your life. It seems like it just goes on and on and on. And you look at your watch, I can't believe it's only been 40 seconds. But most seizures stop really fast. The longer the seizure goes on, the more dangerous it is, the more likely bad. During the seizure, the person is burning up oxygen, producing carbon dioxide. They're burning up sugar, producing lactic acid. And the longer the seizure goes on, the more likely bad things, as in cardiac arrest, are likely to happen. But most seizures last less than 1 minute. That's the reason why we do not need, absolutely need to have an anticonvulsant drug in the emergency kit. Most seizures do not result in injury. If I'm lying on this carpeting, I'm not going to be injured. I'll be sore because my muscles are contracting, but I'm not going to be injured. Intraoral injury occurs in only half of these patients. And what the intraoral injury is something I did last night. I had a nice, healthy meal over at Ed Morton's last night. The lava cake is so good. That's after a 20-pound piece of meat, but that's another story entirely, you know. I took a bite out of this piece of meat, and I got my tongue. You have a bite, the lateral border of your teeth. Eating a sandwich, take a bite out of it, and you crunch your tongue between your molars. That's what you do. That's what they do. It doesn't lead to bleeding. It's simply soft tissue injury. Okay, so we're not going to be a hero. We're not going to do too many things to a victim during a seizure. What you are seeing during the seizure is actually something that's pretty good. Central nervous system stimulation is good to a point. But you see respiratory stimulation, their breathing is perfectly fine. Cardiovascular stimulation, there's nothing terribly wrong with that either. Epileptics have seizures. They have seizures at home. There's nobody there. They go to work the next day. This is not bad. This is the phase. By the way, it's called the ichthyal phase. Ichthyal as in ichthyologist, a person who studies fish. This person looks like a fish flopping around out of water during their seizure. The ichthyal phase of a seizure. Stimulation of the brain, respiratory, and cardiovascular systems. So what do? We're going to leave the victim in a chair. Supine position. We're not going to do anything for the airway. We're not going to do anything for breathing. Not do anything for circulation. They're fine. Definitive care is going to be to simply prevent the victim from getting injured. That's all you want to do. And you'll see this in the video in a moment. You want to prevent injury. The only negative with a dental chair is it's narrow. You know, if you've got a king-size bed and you're epileptic, you lie down in the middle of the bed, you're fine. If you have a narrow bed, the possibility of falling off and getting injured exists. A dental chair is narrow. So our job is going to be to help keep that patient in the dental chair during their seizure. So I'll go over all this in a moment. Here's an interesting question that I can't answer for you. Do you call 911? I don't have the answer for you. Here's the answer for you, I think. If you've never seen one, if this is the first one you've ever seen, you're going to call 911. You know why? You're scared. But if you treat a lot of handicapped patients, and I treat a lot of handicapped patients, and I've seen lots and lots of seizures, you know what? It's a seizure. I don't mean to make it sound blasé, but it's a seizure. It's another seizure. If anybody in this room lives with a person who has epilepsy, hey, Mom, John's having a seizure. Okay, I'll be right in. You know, it's just that you learn to live with it. So the decision to call 911 is yours. It's not mine. But I don't know what to do because I've never seen little Johnny have a seizure before. And one of the things that's nice about this is epileptics don't have driver's licenses. So somebody is in the waiting room who brought them to the clinic, to the office. It might be the mother, husband, wife, friend, whatever it may be. And that person knows this patient better than you do. Mom has seen the kid have seizures for many, many years. So one of the things that I'm going to do, because I've seen seizures before, I'm going to call Mom in, or the husband in, or the wife in, and ask her. And you'll see, we have it in the video. Because Mom has seen this. If Mom sees the kid having a seizure and it looks like it normally does, she'll say, don't call 911. And if Mom walks in and says, oh my God, in other words, she's seeing something that bothers her. All I'm seeing is a kid having a seizure. But she's seeing her kid, and it may look worse than normal. If the parent or husband or wife says, call the paramedics, I'm going to do it. That's my rationale for that bottom of that little question mark. Another thing to keep in mind is nothing goes in the mouth of a convulsing person. Nothing. Forget these tongue depressors wrapped in gauze nonsense that they taught us in dental school. The patient is in tetany. You can't get anything in there. You could give your dog pills more easily than you can get things in this. And dogs don't exactly want to go. Forget about it. It's not going to happen. You want to hurt the patient? Okay, when you force things in that patient's mouth, teeth number 7, 8, 9, and 10 are going to come popping out. Not the whole tooth, just the crown is going to break off. Let's do it again. 7, 8, 9, and 10, crown's going to break off. Nothing goes in that patient's mouth. Look, if that person were home alone having their seizure, nobody would put anything in their mouth. They'd be perfectly fine. Yes, they might
the convulsion begin.
Yes, they might bite the side of their tongue. But that's better than breaking three or four teeth off. All right, so let's see a couple of seizures.
The convulsion begins.
Oh,
it normally lasts for less than 1 minute and rarely for 2 minutes.
Hold up.
Call the parent into the room. Ask them if they think 911 should be called.
Should we call 911?
How long has this been going on?
Oh, about 30 seconds.
The only one he's had?
Yes.
Okay, it's almost over. It's almost over.
It's going to be fine.
Austin?
Talk to the patient.
Austin.
You tell the victim where they are. You tell them what happened. And you tell them that everything is under control.
Austin, Mom's here. Squeeze my hand if you can tell that I'm right here by you.
What happened?
You had a seizure. You had one of your seizures.
Okay. That is all it's about. See, if you, the doctor, are comfortable seeing a seizure, that's what you would do. If you've never seen a seizure, even if mom says it's okay, if you're scared, you call 911. The assumption here is that doctor has seen seizures before. He wants to use the parent who is there to help him. The seizure ends. And now we go into the post-ictal phase. Well, the seizure, the ictal phase, is a fish flopping around out of water. The post-seizure phase is a dead fish. The person is simply lying there. Now, what's scary about this is the rescuers tend to do too much during the seizure. Hold him down. Put something in his mouth. We over-treat the seizure, and then when the seizure stops, we stop. It's over. And you stand up and you take a deep breath and whew. Now, the fact that he's lying there, CNS depressed, which means he's semi-conscious or unconscious, the fact that his breathing is depressed, he might be snoring or he might not be breathing, and there may be a drop in blood pressure, that's dangerous. We stand up and do nothing. If he's not breathing well, he's getting in less oxygen, retaining carbon dioxide, none of which is good. Most serious morbidity, as in brain damage, occurs after the seizure is over, because the rescuer simply stops. Now is when you need to do something. And something goes back to your positioning. He's still going to be in a supine position. See, if you hear snoring, snoring means the airway is partially obstructed. The tongue is relaxed. It falls back into the airway. If you simply do head tilt, chin lift, airway's fine. That's all you have to do. You know, when they say that a person swallows their tongue during a seizure, give me a break. If anybody took anatomy and got even a D or better, you understand that you cannot swallow your tongue. It's impossible. What they're talking about is what happens when the muscles relax and gravity forces the tongue back in the airway. It simply falls back in the airway. And all you have to do, you don't go to the tongue, you simply lift the chin. Head tilt, chin lift takes care of the swallowed tongue thing in seizures. It's all you have to do. Maintain an airway. Go back and do your A, B, and C. It's all you have to do. And what you normally have to do is simply maintain an airway. That's all you have to do. If you hear snoring, it means they're breathing. It just means the breathing is partially obstructed. The pulse is going to be there. Very, very simple. The patient wakes up. I hate that term. The patient wakes up, becomes more aware of what's going on, and following a seizure is mentally disoriented. Mom in the last video, Austin, this is your mother. You're in the dental office and you've had a seizure. Everything is okay. Try to reorient the patient, to tell them that everything, you know, they're waking up in a fog, not having a clue what's going on. You tell them where they are, what happened, that everything is under control. The positioning we already discussed, so let's just go on to why 911. Why 911, to make it really, really, really simple, is because you are uncomfortable. If you're uncomfortable with this patient having a seizure, do not hesitate to call 911. If mom is not there, they dropped them off and left. You don't know whether this is a normal seizure for this patient. Call 911. If you are uncomfortable, get help. We're going to show mom coming back into the room on her kid. And mom is going to see something. And all I'm seeing is Austin having a seizure. I have no idea whether it's normal or not for him. But she's going to see something that bothers her, and she's going to tell us to call the paramedic. Now, when the paramedics arrive on the scene, I want you to watch. These are real paramedics, and we simply told them to do what you normally do. And they blew me away with what they did, because let me give you like a heads up on this. I do a lot of sedation in pediatrics. And the problem when I have a 2 or 3 or 4 year old kid coming into the operating room for general anesthesia is they're crying in the parking lot. And we've given them oral sedation. It doesn't do a damn thing most of the time. And as the kid is being carried in, they're grabbing at anything they can grab onto. A child is literally fighting for their life. And we wind up using bigger doses of medications on little kids than we do on adults because of this extreme fear they have. So one of the things that we do is we have the parent, we have to give the kid a drug called ketamine or a drug called midazolam to quiet the kid down. So we have the pain. I have to give my injection. This kid is, you know, possessed. So dad or mom sits in a chair with the kid on their lap. And the kid is 3 or 4 years old. On their lap, and they put their arms around the kid. You know, they're sitting, the kid is facing the same way as the parent. Put their arms around the kid so the kid can't move his arms. I used to be the one who gave the injection, but I got kicked in the groin 2 or 3 times by kids, and I stopped doing it because it really hurt. So I let my students do it. This is a good learning experience. And it's interesting because we take the drug and we stick it in the leg. Now, we always say to the parent, we inform consent, but can you handle it? Can you handle holding your kid and seeing a needle go into his leg? And dad said, yes. We've had 5 dads faint. We've given the kid the injection, and all of a sudden dad is like that, you know. But you have to give an injection. The injection works, but it's traumatic to everybody. So we started back in the late 1990s taking the same drug, midazolam. It's a Valium-like drug, but it's better. And instead of giving an intramuscular, by the way, we learned this technique from cocaine abusers. You snort a line of cocaine into the nose. The nose is very vascular. The drug is absorbed rapidly. And we started squirting, not injecting, but no needles. Squirt the drug in the kid's nose. And guess what? It worked as well as the intramuscular injection, and no needle. So that's what we were doing for about 3 or 4 years when we made this video. Then we said to the paramedics, come in and do your thing. So I want you to watch. You're going to hear the paramedic make the comment about how much does he weigh. Then you're going to see a syringe in the kid's nose. They're using the same drug we're using. We're using the drug as a sedative. See, here's what's happening. The kid has a normal functioning brain, and we want to depress it. That's what sedation's all about. This kid's brain is hyperexcitable. They want to depress it back to normal. Same drug, different starting point. So watch the video now.
Linda, would you call 911 or ask for medical?
If the parent notices that something about the seizure is different and tells you to call 911, immediately do so.
I'll be waiting for you outside. You'll be all right. Thank you. You'll be all right, baby. You'll be all right. I'll go down and wait for you.
While waiting for the paramedics to arrive on the scene, one rescuer stands by the patient's arms, one by the patient's legs, gently holding, protecting the victim from injury.
Yeah, this is lasting too long. Are the paramedics on their way?
On arrival on the scene, once the seizure has stopped, the paramedics will stabilize the victim and transport them to the hospital for definitive care.
That's what we're getting ready to do. How much does he weigh?
He weighs 80 pounds.
Have your son transported to the hospital and get him evaluated for the seizure thing. I know he's probably had some in the past, but anytime we have some that don't stop, we'd like to go ahead and get him checked out.
We're going to lift you up and move you over.
What's his name?
It's Austin.
Austin.
Austin, you're doing great.
Austin, I'll try to get you soon. I'm going to the hospital with you. You'll be all right.
Okay. Now, there's one more seizure that's a little bit worse than this. Okay, I am going to jump ahead to the allergy part of this. I want to make certain I get this done. So when you download the handout, if you do that, all of the material is on here, some stuff I'm not discussing with you right now, but I do want to discuss allergy with you because it's a very important, very important. So the allergic reaction. That slide I showed you earlier of the pediatric dentist from Wilmington, Delaware, the newspaper, this is what happened in her office. Patient is 6-year-old boy. He's going to have dental work done. Many pediatric dentists will allow the parent to be in the room. It's a way of behavior modification, theoretically. Parent is in the room, sitting just below the dental assistant, watching what the doctor is doing. It's the mother, and, you know, the kid gets local anesthetic, 2/3 of a cartridge of lidocaine, irrelevant to what happens to the mother. The treatment starts, and within a matter of minutes, the mother, all of a sudden, is having an extremely hard time breathing. Wheezing is audible. And, you know, she stands up, she's having, doctor, I can't breathe. Doctor, I can't breathe. So the doctor stops what she's doing, and asks the parent these questions. You know, what is it? Well, wheezing is asthma. Bronchospasm is asthma. Bronchospasm is also allergy. It's also part of the anaphylactic reaction. So she asked the parent, the mother, about anything, any medication you might have taken. Well, I've been taking this medication for a while, and yesterday I developed a rash, which I'm presuming is from the drug, and I stopped taking the medication. But the medication was one of these 24-hour drugs. So the drug is still in her body the next day. And apparently what happened was this itching hives and a rash, this benign, very typical allergy, became worse. And worse means it affects breathing. When allergy involves only the skin, it's not life-threatening, it's annoying. Itching is very annoying, but it doesn't take your life. Once an allergic reaction involves your breathing or the cardiovascular system, your life is in immediate jeopardy. So we know there's a problem. The patient's primary complaint is, I can't breathe. And there's audible wheezing. Wheezing, again, by definition, is bronchospasm. And the two possible diagnoses here, I'm doing this a lot more scientifically than you would do in your office. The presumptive diagnoses here are two. She has an asthmatic attack, or she's having an anaphylactic reaction. Given that mom doesn't have asthma, then if you eliminate that one, our diagnosis is going to be anaphylaxis. And it doesn't really matter because the treatment is the same. The treatment of the asthmatic attack or the anaphylactic reaction would be exactly the same. But she's wheezing. Wheezing ain't good. Wheezing means the airway is narrowing down. So what did the doctor do? She got the emergency kit. Let's go to the emergency kit. Let's go, go, go. Keep on pressing the button, Dr. Melamed. They position the victim comfortably. Now, if you're having difficulty breathing, the only position the victim will get into is sitting up, because you can breathe better sitting up. Another person in the staff got the emergency kit. Somebody else called 911. In the emergency drug kit, there are two injectable drugs. We have diphenhydramine, Benadryl, and antihistamine. We have epinephrine, 1 to 1,000. Now, the way most people think, ooh, epi 1 to 1,000, really potent drug, I don't want to use it. Benadryl, benign. So let's give her Benadryl first, and let's cross our fingers and hope it works. So she gave the Benadryl. Doesn't do a thing. If she was itching, she would stop itching. But she wasn't itching. She was having a hard time breathing, and it didn't work. She realized this rapidly, and she got out the other drug, which is epinephrine, adrenaline, epinephrine, in a preloaded syringe, put it in. Waited 5 minutes, paramedics hadn't arrived. Patient hadn't gotten better. Gave a second dose, 5 minutes later. The paramedics did arrive after that. And their job, again, is stabilize and transport. So they're going to start an IV, assess the patient, give additional drugs if needed. Off to the hospital the patient goes. And you know what? She survived. Most people who have anaphylactic reactions will be hospitalized in the emergency department for a couple of hours. A couple of hours under observation and then sent home. Under observation means we want to be certain you're getting better, not worse, before you walk out that door. Couple of hours. And in a more severe case, it might even be overnight. The fact that she was hospitalized for 3 days is indicative of a rather severe anaphylactic reaction. And again, the headline I showed you was, Dennis thinks fast saves a life. So it can be done. She knew what to do and wasn't afraid to do it. The Mayo Clinic proceedings of February 2003, case report. I love the title of this one, The Kiss of Death. The kiss of, come here, Monica. The kiss of death. This young lady has a shellfish allergy. By the way, even though there's no relationship between latex and shellfish, what happened here is what happens in dentistry. The most common allergy to shellfish is a contact dermatitis. You touch a shrimp with your fingers get red, itchy, skin begins to get, you know, crack. Put gloves on. Latex, same thing, contact dermatitis, itchy, red, cracked fingers. She has had this allergy to shellfish for many, many, many years, and it's only been a contact dermatitis. She and her boyfriend go out to dinner. Now remember, this is a young couple in love, not an old married couple in love, where I go to kiss my wife, I get the cheek occasionally. You know, she turns her head quickly, you know. If I'm being honored tonight, I will get the side of the face, the cheek, you know. But this is a young couple in love, and it's a passionate kiss. And if you ever watch CSI, you can now see the animation is occurring. They show the external shot of the kiss occurring, mouth open kiss, and then they show the animation of her soft tissue in her mouth. Her tongue and her vocal cords begin to swell. Called laryngeal edema, part of the allergic reaction. Luckily, wherever she was, they had the stuff there. They had epinephrine, and they gave it to her, and she survived. The kiss of death. I mean, it's an interesting title. It's a great title. And what's scary about this, I already mentioned these doctors. These three dentists who have died from latex anaphylaxis. They had latex allergy for years. It was simply a matter of my skin. My hands are itchy and red. And the next time, they died. Anaphylaxis can happen any time. This is one medical emergency you cannot prevent. I mean, the only way you prevent allergies is by asking a patient, before I give Monica penicillin, have you ever had penicillin before? Yes, I have. 10 times? 20 times? Yeah. You ever have an adverse reaction? No. But the 21st time could be it. That's what's scary. That's why, as healthcare providers, people who are prescribing drugs, who are injecting drugs, the only two drugs in our kit that are injectable are to treat the anaphylactic reaction, because you can't always prevent it. Very, very simple. So I want to get into the treatment of it before we finish. Allergy is a very simple concept. Your body's immune system is over-responding. Over-responding to what? Shellfish, peanuts, latex, ester-type local anesthetics, penicillin, to anything. The thing which provokes the allergy is called an allergen. An allergen is something that the body recognizes as an enemy, and the immune system over-responds. And you're actually, all those clinical signs and symptoms that are killing you are being produced by your own body. Your body is responding way, way out of proportion to what's going on. And essentially, in your immune system, there are lots of different types of cells, but the one we're dealing with right now is called a mast cell, M-A-S-T. Mast cells are found in high concentrations in skin. That's why most allergy is only involving the skin, itching, hives, and a rash. Mast cells are found in high concentrations in the lungs and in the cardiovascular system. And inside the mast cell are chemicals, and they're called the chemical mediators of allergy. But those chemicals are inside the cell. They're walled off from the rest of the body. And what happens in the allergic reaction is when let's make it the shellfish. When the shellfish protein attaches to the mast cell, it releases the chemicals into whatever tissue it's in. And when she touched it with her fingers, it was the mast cells in her hand that released the histamine. And histamine produces itching, hives, and a rash. That's the chemical found inside the mast cell. There are other chemicals there also, but histamine is the major one. And if that histamine, if that mast cell were in her lungs, histamine produces bronchospasm. It narrows down the airway. And if those mast cells were in her cardiovascular system and histamine is released, it makes blood vessels get larger, which leads to two things: swelling of the soft tissue and a drop in blood pressure. So what you're dealing with in allergy is your body's response to a foreign substance. In discussing allergy as an emergency, as we're doing right now, predicting the severity. Remember, on my survey I went through earlier today, the number two most common emergency was mild allergy. Anaphylaxis was like number 11. It was way down the list. Most allergic reactions are not life-threatening. The ones that are the ones that start the fastest. Now, I'll give you numbers in a moment. The sooner the signs and symptoms of allergy occur, the more likely the response is to be bad. The slower the onset, you know what? It's mild, usually. Always exceptions to any rule. So, delayed onset allergy, delayed onset, where the signs and symptoms develop an hour or more later. So it's 11:18 right now. At 9 o'clock this morning, at 10:18 this morning, an hour ago, I ate a bag of peanuts. 1 hour later, I begin to feel itchy all over. Delayed onset allergy, most likely non-life threatening. I'm going to fly Southwest Airlines home. No chance in hell, but make believe. Okay, this is a real fantasy. Okay, I'm going to fly Southwest Airlines home because Southwest Airlines is the only airline that still gives out bags of peanuts. No other airline does. And I have a peanut allergy. So when they come around on the airplane and they offer peanuts and soft drinks or whatever drink you want, I'm going to say, I want a Diet Coke and I can't have peanuts because I'm allergic to them. I can't have peanuts. Monica and like peanuts. I'm lucky enough to be sitting between these two. It's going to be a great flight. Unfortunately, we'll be sitting a lot closer than that. But, you know, so Monica or
Dava?
Dava. They take their bag of peanuts and they open it up. The minute you smell it, you're inhaling peanut protein. And people die from that. People have died on airplanes just smelling the peanuts. It's scary. Now, so what I said wrong a moment ago, I said if I say to the flight attendant, I'll have a Diet Coke, but I'm allergic to peanuts on Southwest Airlines, they will not give out peanuts to anybody on the airplane. If you say you're allergic, nobody on the airplane gets peanuts. Give you bags of pretzels. And they also announce your seat number. The reason you're getting the stale bag of pretzels is 4D. So, rapid onset, life-threatening as a rule. This is an allergic skin reaction. Welts, red, itching, very uncomfortable. The treatment would be, let's go back to our PA, B, and C. There's nothing to do. Positioning is whatever he wants. Airway breathing circulation need not be done because he's okay. Definitive care is oral antihistamines. Now, the one thing to take away, this is not the major emergency here, but the one thing to take away about delayed onset allergy is 3 days. Whenever you prescribe an antihistamine like Benadryl to be taken for allergy, it's a 3-day regimen. And the reason is, once those chemicals are released into the tissue, they stay in that tissue for 72 hours. Not in the same, you know, in diminishing concentrations, but whenever you treat the allergic reaction, you've got to treat it for 3 days. Okay? Very, very simple. Now, anaphylaxis. By definition, it's life-threatening. As a rule, it's rapid onset. It involves breathing, and it involves the cardiovascular system. You've heard the term anaphylactic shock. That simply implies that there's a significant drop in blood pressure as a part of this anaphylactic reaction. What do? It's simple, folks, PABCD. You position the victim appropriately. Now, if their chief complaint is, I'm having difficulty breathing, you let them sit up. If their chief complaint is, there is none because they're unconscious, you lay them down. In other words, we're doing nothing different than we did earlier. It's positioning as appropriate, airway as needed, breathing as needed, chest compression as needed. You still start out with your PABCD, D, definitive care. Anaphylaxis is the only medical emergency in dentistry where you absolutely, positively have to inject drugs. No ifs, no ands, no buts. You have to give drugs. The drug you're going to give is epinephrine, given immediately, and then every 5 minutes until one of two things happen. The victim recovers or somebody arrives on the scene and takes over the victim's management. People with anaphylactic reactions, victims of anaphylaxis, who get epinephrine promptly have a better chance of survival. Victims of anaphylaxis who don't get epinephrine usually die. People who get epinephrine but don't get it soon enough are likely to die. The faster the drug is given, the better the chance of surviving anaphylaxis. These next couple of slides basically repeat what I just showed you, but they come from the experts. These are the guidelines published by the Academy of Allergy and Immunology. It's like we have the CPR guidelines from the cardiologists, antibiotic guidelines. We have guidelines on anaphylaxis. And I'm quoting from then 2005 guidelines. And it's almost what I said before. The more rapidly anaphylaxis develops, the more likely the reaction is to be severe and potentially life-threatening. Prompt recognition of signs and symptoms of anaphylaxis is crucial. Now, this next part in red is really important. If there is any doubt, I'm not sure, it is better to give epinephrine than not. If you're not certain, it is better to give epinephrine than not. Remember, this is epinephrine 1 to 1,000. What they're saying to you is don't be afraid of this drug. It's a life-saving drug. Epinephrine and oxygen are the most important therapeutic agents in anaphylaxis. Epinephrine is drug of choice, and the appropriate dose is given now at the onset of apparent anaphylaxis. You understand? They're saying to you, if you're not sure, give that drug. This is the one that's the most important one. There's no contraindication to giving it. But wait a minute, Dr. Malamud, my patient's blood pressure is 240. Yeah? And if he has anaphylaxis, you don't give it to him, it'll be zero. He had a massive myocardial infarction, just left the hospital 2 hours ago. Yeah? And he got stung by a bee. And if you don't give him epi, we go to the funeral tomorrow. That's what this is saying to you, folks. There is no absolute contraindication to using epinephrine during the anaphylactic reaction because it saves lives. Now, let's go back to our D, definitive care. Definitive care. We did our P, A, B, and C, definitive care. Epi, 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 epi. I said it four times. Epi, 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 epi. You need at least two doses. You need probably three or four. Think about how much time it takes 911 to arrive in your office. If you give the first dose of epi right now, second dose is given 5 minutes later, third dose is given in 10 minutes, fourth dose is given in 15. If the paramedics arrive in your office, within 10 minutes, one syringe will work. But the third dose, this syringe contains, well, Twinject. Hello, Twinject. I wish it were Triject, but it's Twinject. So the first dose of this syringe is given now, second dose 5 minutes later. If help is not there at 10 minutes, you need a second syringe. And the second syringe is good for 10 minutes and 15 minutes. You understand what I'm saying? You need to have a couple of these around. This is new. This has been on the market only about a year, maybe a year and a half. I showed you the EpiJect on the video. This is new. This is better. This is much better. So what you're going to be doing for definitive care is epi every 5 minutes and 911. And if you are alone with the victim, you give the epi first. You give the epinephrine first. Why epinephrine? Because what you die from is bronchospasm. You can't breathe. Epinephrine is the best bronchodilator bar none. You die from the drop in blood pressure. Epinephrine raises the blood pressure. What epinephrine does not do is reverse the edema. What epinephrine does do, it prevents the edema from getting any worse. And that's where you have to give it in a hurry. When that young lady kissed her boyfriend and her tongue began to swell, when they gave her epi, it didn't make the swelling go away, but it didn't get any worse. So if the swelling is only minimal, it stays that way. But if you wait and you wait and you're not sure and the swelling gets worse and worse, then the airway is gone. And giving epi is not going to save her life. And that is why a layperson who has an allergy to whatever it may be carries around an epinephrine syringe. You don't have the luxury of calling 911 and waiting. You will be dead in a serious allergy. You will be dead before they arrive. So here's the video from the Twinject.
Because of the danger associated with severe anaphylactic reactions, your doctor has prescribed the Twinject auto-injector, which contains two doses of epinephrine. Epinephrine is the most effective emergency treatment available for anaphylaxis. Epinephrine is indicated to stop symptoms and keep them from recurring while you're waiting for emergency help to arrive. Your Twinject comes with simple step-by-step directions for use. Directions for injecting the first dose of epinephrine are located directly on your Twinject. Remove the cap labeled 1. Next, remove the cap label 2. Be careful not to place your thumb, finger, or hand over the injection tip. Place the tip against the middle of the outer side of your thigh. TwinJect is designed to go through clothing. Press down hard until the needle penetrates your skin and enters your thigh. Hold the TwinJect in place while slowly counting to 10. Remove the TwinJect from your thigh. If the needle is exposed, the medication has been delivered. Immediately call 911 for emergency medical attention. While you wait, prepare to give yourself a second injection. You may not need it, but it's still important to have it ready in case your symptoms fail to improve. To prepare the second dose, unscrew and remove the injection tip. Hold the blue hub at the base of the needle and pull the syringe from the TwinJect, being careful to avoid the exposed needle. Remove the yellow collar from the plunger. Place the syringe in a safe place nearby where the exposed needle is protected. If you do not feel better within about 10 minutes, or if you feel the symptoms returning, you may need a second dose of epinephrine. Studies show that 1 out of 3 people may experience a reaction severe enough to require a second dose. To give yourself the second dose, put the needle into your thigh through the skin. Push the plunger down all the way, then remove the needle from your skin.
Oh, I guess that's it. Now, I'm going to just have 2 more concluding slides that I want to show you because it's 11:29 and 30-something seconds. Right here. Okay. So, positioning, airway, breathing, circulation, basic life support for everybody. Have an emergency kit. You need one. If you have some of these kits that you bought out there on the exhibit floor years ago, take a good look at them and see what's in there, because legally you are responsible for being able to use any drug that's in that kit. And if you buy kits that have injectable drugs that must be given intravenously, they're worthless in your hands. Get rid of them. You need to have this, you need to have stuff, but the stuff that you have should be usable by you. Got it? Look at it carefully. Basic life support. If you're from one of those 10 states that don't require CPR, come on, get a life. Okay, come on, be smart. Okay, train your staff. Bring somebody into your dental office to teach you in this. By the way, don't take a class out of your office. You're training your staff to save a life in your dental office. Bring the instructor in. Put the mannequin on the floor in the reception room. Put the mannequin in the dental chair. Now, I'm going to discuss this afternoon. And I'll give you a little clue that, you know what? You leave the person in the chair. If they have a cardiac arrest in the dental chair, you'll leave them in the chair, because a dental chair is perfectly okay for doing chest compression. But you need to have the entire staff trained. And again, the reason I said that is I'm good at doing CPR, but I don't know about him. And I can keep him alive, but I think it's only fair that we reciprocate here. You got it? With that, I'm going to hang around a little bit if anybody has any questions for me. I'm going to be over in this other, if I can find this place by 1:45, I'll be over there. But I want you, welcome to San Francisco and enjoy your stay here. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Melbed, for another brilliant lecture. And what everybody wants to know is the verification number. First of all, ADA hopes you've had a good time. And please go to the exhibits and see some of the exhibitors. And I think after this lecture, you got to go check some new medical emergency kits. Now, the course number, as you know, is 5309. You write that down someplace. And next to that, the verification code that you've been here for 2.5 hours is 2613. 2613 is your verification code. And please do not leave anything behind, garments or anything. So we'll see you this afternoon. What's that? The number is 2613.